All right, we are live.
Great, thank you, Jonathan. I'd like to call to order the Hood River City Council meeting of October 26th. And I'd just like to take about 15 seconds of silence to remember who took care of this land years and years ago, and how well they took care of it, and how much we love it now because they took care of it previously. So just take 15 seconds of silence. Okay. Business from the audience. We have 10 people that have signed up. And I have four people that kind of are going to be talking about, I would call them miscellaneous things, some which are on our agenda, but kind of more miscellaneous things. And then I have three people that would like to speak about in-lieu parking. And so I'm going to put the in-lieu parking people in front of when we talk about in-lieu parking, so they can keep that fresh in our minds when we're doing that. And then I also have three people that would like to speak on the hearing that we're gonna do, the public hearing. So in order for them to be able to have their information in the record, I'm gonna save those people to speak during that record, during our public hearing. So the people that, Jonathan, so that you can know who these are, the first people that'll speak right now for business from the audience are firstly, Lorraine Lyons, on Parklets, Tracy Thomas-Paul, Cascade and Rand Road is the subject, Pamela Larson on Community Dialogue, and Claire Culbertson on Rand Road. So Lorraine Lyons would be our first speaker for business from the audience this evening.
Good morning, everyone. Oh, it's been a long day. Good evening, everyone. How are you?
We're good. You have 3 minutes, Lorraine.
Okay. I just wanted to share with you my experience with the Parklets this summer and some of the feedback that I've gotten. And I also wanted to just offer to hopefully be part of the process if in fact they come back. Literally hundreds of people, locals, visitors, have been so grateful to have an outside space where they felt safe, they felt safe being approached by servers. Our employees have felt so incredibly safe. It has been obviously a lifesaver for our business. I mean, we wouldn't have made it through the summer without it, without a doubt. And I thank all of you for your support in helping us again with that. So I don't know what the plans are going forward for the spring. I'm hopeful that we will have them back. But I will tell you that I think there's some things that we could do to make them better and make them safer. And there's a number of things we could do. But I just wanted to say that it has been a game changer for downtown Hood River. And there's been a lot of great suggestions from visitors about Parklets and Oak Street and some ideas that have been tossed around. So I just wanted to let you know that they were received very, very well by the masses, and they were very, very helpful to the small business owners that had them. And I'm hopeful that we can have them back in the spring. It doesn't seem like this is going to be over anytime soon. So if we could get a planning process going so we could all be prepared and maybe have some, very clear guidelines so we could all be prepared if in fact we get them back next year. And that's really all I had to say. It's just all good news. I mean, nothing bad. We just want them back.
Thank you, Lorraine, for your appreciate it.
You bet.
Tracy is next.
I do not see Tracy in attendance and the phone number does not align with the one that I have. I don't have one for her, actually. I do see other two speakers, though.
Is someone raising their hand?
Ah, okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Is this Tracy? Yeah.
Yes, it is. Sorry, I'm. It looks like Fish Food Bank, but this is not Fish Food Bank. It's Tracy.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. In April and October this year, Councillors Saunders and Zanmiller complained about the spiraling costs for the Cascade and Rand Road construction project. Mark asked whether the contract could become null and void because of the increases. He said, quote, "I have no faith that they're not going to do it to us again and they'll change the rules again and it's another bajillion dollars." Megan said, "You guys have heard me harp on this before, but basically we're at the mercy of the state to just be on the hook for whatever they say we're on the hook for." Mark, Megan, and Kate had the opportunity and responsibility to review the contract that the city signed on July 10th, 2017. The municipal code says, quote, "The city council is designated to continue as the local contract review board of the city." These folks were among the 2017 city council members responsible for reviewing the contract and approving it. What happened? And what does that contract bind the city to? The intergovernmental agreement limits federal funding to $750,000. Hood River signed up to be, quote, "responsible for all remaining costs, including the city's required match for all eligible costs, any non-participating costs, and all costs in excess of the available federal or state funds." And, quote, "if the actual costs of the project exceed the estimated total project costs set forth in this agreement, the city is responsible for all costs." In fact, the state can award a construction contract, quote, "at 10% over engineer's estimate without the city's prior approval." What questions were asked by the city council back about the contract in 2017? Check the minutes for the discussion if you can find them. City Attorney Dan Kearns signed the contract but did not speak out recently to advise councilors that they could apply to void the contract if the state agrees. During the next budget review, the public might want to look closely at the revenues and expenses in the road fund and see whether the estimates for spending are reasonable, given that construction expenses for Cascade and Rand remain unknown at this time but have no caps. Any new state contracts for the 2nd and Oak Street Signal project merit a close review of contract conditions too, something that council members are obligated to do on behalf of the city. The current councilors who've been loudest in protesting Cascade and Rand costs and asking ODOT engineers to plead with the state for more money were on the council that approved the contract. Why not admit they either didn't read the contract, didn't ask the right questions, or got faulty advice? The contract doesn't run out until 2027. The costs can continue to rise since there's no cap. Mark, Megan, and Kate should admit they're accountable for the 2017 contract and stop being outraged at the state of Oregon for merely carrying out its side of the contract that the city council at that time approved. Thank you.
Okay, Pamela Larson. Pamela, if you're on a phone, you need to hit *6 to unmute yourself.
Okay. Hello, this is Pamela.
Okay, you're on. You have 3 minutes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, all of you, for serving on Hood River City Council and for your time. And also, Mayor, thank you for that moment of silence. So I'm a local independent educator who teaches tribal history, and I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about this idea of community dialogues. So as a community member, I have just noticed that, you know, currently our nation seems to be very polarized politically and socially, and at times the conflicts in other areas in our country, the citizens have become kind of violent. So our country is a place that has sought to be a place where a diversity of voices can not only be tolerated, but really encouraged. So right now, many people don't feel safe to voice their opposing opinions. And I've been reaching out to people. I talked to Pastor Grace from the Hood River Alliance Church, and he feels that people are growing very hateful to each other, and there's a tendency even to demonize the other side. And this is really sad to me, and I don't feel it has to be this way. And so I came up with this idea of community dialogues, and the purpose would be to bring community members together that have a varying political and social perspectives to talk in a safe and respectful environment with the facilitator. No one's trying to change somebody's point of view. There's no political agenda, no platforms for any candidates. It's just about inviting people to come together and be curious and not judgmental and to share. And I see it as an opportunity to build some bridges between people in our area that are maybe feeling a bit polarized by, you know, the situation in our nation. And we're a small community. We can talk to each other. I feel that, you know, it's important to get some bridges made as right now things seem to be getting more and more polarized. So I'm proposing a pilot program this Saturday, and it's kind of an invite only of moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans. Vicki Strifford from the Riverside Church, she'll be the facilitator. I have a doctor coming who's going to do kind of the taking temperatures and talking about the state mandated COVID ideas. And it's going to be at Tucker Park at 10 a.m., done by noon. And I've invited many people. I've talked to Sergeant Pete at the sheriff. I've talked to also the Pastor Terry at the River of Life Church. I've reached out to a retired Oregon State Trooper. Anyway, it would be wonderful to somehow have the county and the city involved. I talked to one county commissioner, and he was like, wow, this would be great to bring the city and the county together, both governing bodies and law enforcement, to participate in this.
Thank you. Appreciate you putting all this effort into it and putting the information out on a public meeting. And I assume it's open to anyone that wants to come. You're saying moderate and moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats, but I assume it would be open to all. And so thank you for doing this. I think it's important and appreciate you putting the effort into it.
Thanks.
Okay. Claire Culbertson.
Okay, can you hear me?
We can hear you, Claire.
Okay. Okay, my name is Claire Culbertson, and I live in Hood River, and I've been interested for some time in the need for affordable housing here. I'm concerned about low-income housing, and especially after losing the 65 units of low-income housing planned for the Lot 700 project. I'm very excited to see the Rand Road project advancing. In reviewing the proposals submitted by the Leland Group, several issues come to mind that need to be addressed in the work going forward. First, the proposal states that stakeholder interviews may include neighbors, neighborhood association leaders, affordable housing advocates, and housing developers. Unfortunately, I didn't see any mention of the end users in this list. How do we ensure that people who need low-income housing will have their voices heard? The city's 2019 update of the housing needs analysis identify several demographic groups whose input should be specifically sought. These include the increasing percentage of Hood River's population that's over 60 years old, and the increasing percentage that's Hispanic or Latino. Expecting that these important potential end user groups will be adequately represented among the neighborhood and neighborhood associations is unrealistic. Second, in the proposal's scope of work description, I didn't see mention of factoring in actual data on where the need is. We have that data. The housing needs analysis update I just mentioned documents rapidly rising housing prices and rent costs in Hood River over the last several years. Since completion of the original housing needs analysis in 2015, the cost burden segment of households, those paying 30 to 50% of their income on housing costs, increased from 32% to 37% of all households. The largest increase in being cost burden was for renters, increasing from 40% to 48% of renters. The percentage of severely cost burden renters, those paying 50% or more of their income on housing costs, increased from 15% to 22%. This data show that Hood River's housing is becoming less affordable to all households, but especially for renter households. I ask that the city specify end user groups, including older adults and Latinos, as specific stakeholder groups to be included in Leland's assessment process. And I ask that the city direct the Leland group to specifically incorporate the housing needs analysis update data in its planning. And I thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We're going to do, then all the other speakers will come later in the agenda. And we are going to go ahead and open the public hearing. And so we have a staff report, but I have a script I need to read for that public hearing. So we're going to start with that. So this is for a public hearing for Nature's Miracle Zone Change upon the request of IBC file number 2020-13. I'd like to call to order the hearing of the Hood River City Council on the aforementioned file number. And this is a description of tonight's process for this legislative action. This is not quasi-judicial. First, our function in land use cases is to review the record, take public testimony, and determine whether the application meets or does not meet the approval criteria in the Hood River Development Code. It is not our job to be more restrictive or lenient than those approval standards allow, but rather to interpret and apply the approval standards as written. Second, we are required to render an impartial decision on each application. This means that we cannot have a personal financial stake or bias that would prevent us from making an impartial decision. Before I begin, I will call for the disclosures of bias, ex parte contact, and conflicts of interest from each counselor. And then anyone from the audience will have an opportunity to question any of us about those disclosures. So does anyone have a conflict of interest this evening? Okay, I see a no from Gladys, a no from Jessica, a no from Tim, a no from Mark. Eric, no, okay. Megan?
I don't know if it's a conflict of interest. I don't know if you're going through like ex parte and other stuff. Or if I should do it all now.
Just a conflict of interest right now.
Okay, then no, sorry.
No, okay. Okay, so now let's do any ex parte contact regarding the application. I'll go around again. No Gladys? Jessica?
I walk on the trail near there with my family, but I don't feel like it's an issue.
Okay. Eric?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as Jessica. I've been there, but I don't think I have any stake in it whatsoever.
Okay, and Mark?
None.
Kim?
Nope.
And Megan?
So I'm employed at Farmers Irrigation District, which is an overlapping district for this parcel. And so we were notified of this proposal before it went to Planning Commission. It was the same notice that's in the packet, so I didn't learn any other information, but just wanted to let everyone know.
Okay. All right. Then just, Jonathan, if you want to see if anyone in the audience now needs to question anyone that's on council about if they have an issue with whether ex parte contact or conflict of interest.
Sorry, Kate, I maybe just don't know what bucket it's supposed to go in, but I have something else I guess I want to say.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Megan.
So, I don't know. Clearly, I know how to do these. But just within working for farmers, a zone change would in no way impact farmers' operations, but a subdivision would have a minor financial impact on the budget, would in no way impact my salary or other compensation. So there's no personal financial stake, and I don't think it has caused any prejudgment on our end. But again, I want to disclose that for everyone else.
Okay. Thank you. Now, Jonathan, if anyone has raised their hand from the audience that wants to question any of us.
Mayor, there are no hands raised in the audience.
Thank you. Our decision tonight will be final unless appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals. To appeal our decision, you must participate either orally or in writing before the record closes and raise any issue you might wish to preserve for a subsequent appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals. Once we close the record, that will end your ability to raise new issues or present evidence. First, we will hear the staff report this evening. Then we will hear from the applicant. Then we will take testimony or questions from the public. After the public testimony, the applicant has the right of final rebuttal. The applicant has the last word because an applicant has the burden of proving compliance with the mandatory approval criteria. And finally, after everyone interested in the matters has had a chance to testify, we will close the record, deliberate, and may render a decision tonight. Our decision, however, is not final until it is reduced to writing and officially issued. Some of the basic rules for presenting testimony in tonight's hearing. Only present testimony when you have been provided the floor. Begin with your name and mailing address. Please limit your testimony to the applicable approval criteria identified in the staff report. Failure to raise an issue accompanied by statements or evidence with sufficient specificity to allow us or the parties to respond to the issue will preclude an appeal to the to the Land Use Board of Appeals based on that issue. Failure by the applicant to raise constitutional or other issues related to proposed conditions of approval with sufficient specificity to allow us to respond to the issue will preclude an action for damages in circuit court. So that's it for procedures for tonight's hearing. If anyone has any questions about the process as we go forward, please feel free to ask them during the public testimony portion of the hearing. We will now consider file number 20-2013, an application by IBC Construction requesting zoning map change from R1 to R2 to permit an 18-lot subdivision. A quorum of the council is present, and we have already had disclosures by everyone. And so we will have the staff report.
Thank you, Mayor. This matter comes to you from the Planning Commission. It's a request from IBC for an 18-lot subdivision pending zone change approval. Planning Commission heard this matter on October 5th. It approved the subdivision for 18 lots pending the zone change and recommended the zone change based on compliance with Title 17, Chapter 8. This is the recommendations that has come before you. We have provided notice to neighbors within 250 feet of this property of the request and of this hearing tonight. And I know we have a couple neighbors that have called in and have touched base. So we thank them for participating both in the Planning Commission hearing as well as here at City Council. In your packet from pages 3 to 250 are the materials for this request. They include my staff report, which was modified and turned into the Planning Commission hearing's record, as well as the Planning Commission recommendation. We also have materials from the applicant, including their narrative, which is included in Attachment A, drawings and materials of the subdivision, review comments from both the public as well as our agency partners, which reviewed this matter. And then to really bring this down into a condensed version, I extracted most of the applicable zone criteria and provided it in your cover sheet. Really the key to this matter and this request, it falls in 1708, which is a part of your zoning code, and they list the criteria for a zone change before you. So really on pages 4 to 7 in your packet are really the most significant aspects in the request that City Council is asked to consider on this change from R1, which is a low density zone, to R2, which is your standard density. We look at compliance with the comp plan, changes that have occurred, as well as the need for such a request. The approval criteria as listed in the zoning code include a mistake made on the original designation of the map, and we make no finding that a mistake has been made. Is there a public need for such a change? And will this need be served by changing the zone designation? And have conditions changed within the affected area, the surrounding area? And is the zone change more suitable, or will it interfere with either the use of surrounding properties, or as well as this is essentially a compatibility question. Can the zone change, or will the zone change result in compatible development? So in our findings, which are also included in the packet, that's the short criteria. Planning Commission did find that based upon the submission, as well as some of the housing needs analysis that were actually mentioned earlier tonight from 2015, this represents a consistent change with that. The need to make efficient use of land within the UGB that is available to the city now, the efficiency of this increases that. It also does move towards not only an efficiency aspect, but providing middle housing. R2 provides an opportunity of not only single family homes, but also for duplexes and triplexes that change the number and the diversity of uses that become available here. So with that, we have a recommendation to approve the zone change, and we do have an approved subdivision pending the change. I know we have neighbors here to speak to this matter. We also have the applicant online right now who is available and will be available tonight as you discuss this and review it for questions as well.
Great. Thank you, Dustin. Appreciate it. So next we would have the applicant's testimony. So let's see if we've got, I believe that would be Mike Kettler. And then I don't know if anyone else besides Mike is going to speak representing him. Do you know Dustin?
We also have Sean Wagner in the audience, which who may be available as well. So we could have both. They represent the applicant team.
Okay, great. So Mike, do you want to go ahead first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess I can speak to the compliance that we've already completed, that yes, the finding so far hasn't triggered any red flag in the actual subdivision itself. But I think with that, that's pretty well laid out in the findings. The thing I think I'll speak to is the need that this provides. We need housing. If you look on the current market, available lots are 3. Available lots under $200,000 is 0. The sad part is this will not create affordable housing, but it will at least provide a relief to housing, because by adding lots of this value, that will be probably the price point that these will come out to, is it will take off pressure off of infill lots that are currently being purchased and driven up the price to be scraped and rebuilt as infills. The other piece that this does is we're trying to move from an R1 low density to a standard density, which also is what else is built around it. The R1s that are in your findings that aren't built are county property and undeveloped land to the west. So the zoning that's developed and built out is R2, which is your standard zoning. I think unless you have any other questions, I mean, that's pretty much all we just really want to focus on, is the need for housing and that this opportunity to change from an R1 to an R2 will provide. The difference in lots is from 14 to 18. So it's not a large number, but it is more than what's currently on the market in Hood River today. So yeah.
Okay, Mike, if you, we won't ask questions now, but if you could stick around, when we get to deliberations, there might potentially be some questions for you. Thanks. And then Sean, did you have anything to add as part of the applicant team?
I did not.
Okay, great. So then the next people to speak would be proponents. And I have Mary King and Al and Megan Barton. I think those are the only ones to speak this evening. And we've got, you know, proponents, then we've got neutral, and then we've got opposed. And I don't know, from reading the information in our packet, I believe that all of these people are opposed because they had testimony in our packet that we got. So I don't think there is anyone that's for proponents, but I'm just gonna ask if anyone wants to raise their hand that's an attendee. It doesn't look like anyone's raising their hand.
Sorry, we also have one caller in. I recognize the phone number. It's Linda Maddox. She has called in but not identified. So I believe she may or may not want to participate in the conversation.
Oh, all right. She'd signed up for in-lieu parking, so I didn't realize.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, so we've got neutral, people that are neutral, and then we've got opposed. So let's let Linda speak if she's going to speak either neutral or opposed on this particular subject. And then we will go to Mary King after that.
Linda, you may need to press star 6 to unmute your telephone.
Okay, it's Linda, Linda Maddox.
Your address? Can you hear?
Okay, you can hear me. I just want to make sure. I'm opposed. Do you want me to speak now?
You can speak now because we didn't have any other that were neutral or proponent. So we're on to the opposed, so that's fine. If you could give your address, and we need that because we need, because this is a legislative hearing.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. Great, thanks.
Okay, so Linda Maddox, 3018 Dana Lane, Hood River. And I want to speak to you on about 4 points. And the first one is having to do with zone changes that Dustin did go over quickly, you know, when a zone can be changed, and mentioned all of the basically three conditions. Mistake has been made, a public need, or conditions have changed. And I think there's another statement that he mentioned too. But anyway, that's the gist of it. I feel that the applicant has not made the case for any of those reasons for a zone change. And realize he just very briefly mentioned the need for public housing. I agree, we do need public housing. The problem with the housing that he's proposing is that it's not going to be affordable, as he said. And he has, you know, used different price, I've heard a price range of $500,000 to $550,000. And so it doesn't really match that public need. Okay, another problem I found in reading through the many, many pages of this application, I didn't realize it was actually 250, but it's huge, was a flaw in the transportation analysis. And it was in packet two, the original packet two, pages approximately in the 40s, page 43 to 48. The traffic transportation analysis was analyzing it with the land with 18 lots and what kind, who would be coming, how many trips there'd be in the morning, how many trips in the evening, and how many trips for a week. And basically what I think the Planning Commission didn't understand, and apparently the transportation specialist didn't either, is those 18 lots are all going to be developed as duplexes that eventually will be townhouses. So in essence, there won't be 18 homes, there will be 36 homes. And so there will be many more trips than you have in the transportation analysis that was on page 48 in packet number 2. So I just think it's really important to point that flaw out. But I also think it's really important for the city council to understand, I didn't speak to the planning commission, but to understand that what we're looking at are 18 duplexes, which is 36 units. And my biggest problem with that, I am a neighbor just up the street. I just missed getting noticed, so I'm probably 260 feet away from the site. And the biggest problem I have with it is compatibility. And Dustin did just mention something about that. And I'm concerned because Mike Kettler, the applicant here, is building up 30th Street. And all the duplexes are the same. They all look the same. He's building a number of duplexes. Mike Kitts has built 3, and I think Mike Kettler's built 3. But they're planning to have, 14 or more up there, duplexes. So that's actually 28 units of housing. So then on the other side of the same street, 30th Street, on the north side, what in this application that you're looking at, we're talking about 36 units, home units, basically. And so they are backing up to R1 land, and it would look much better if there were a variety of single family and duplexes mixed, at least as many single family homes as duplexes. That would give more space between owners, and it would be very good if the designs of those, whatever the buildings are, duplexes or single family, be different, be made up of a variety of designs, not all the same.
Could you try to wrap up? I'm trying to give you.
Yeah, I'm about. This is my last point. This is it. This is about it. I will finish. Thank you, Kate. And so I'm very concerned about that there be, if this gets approved, right now I am not for it to be approved at this point because I don't think he's made the case and I don't, and the traffic analysis is wrong. But the most important thing is if it does get approved, I would like to see the city ask for more design variation a mix of single family and duplexes. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Linda. So next would be Mary Kim. I'm trying to give everyone, if they want it, up to 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Great. I appreciate this opportunity to provide testimony about this proposal. My name is Mary King and my address is 3105 Eugene Street, directly downslope from the proposed subdivision. I oppose this rezone and would like to see the City Council also review the subdivision proposal for all the reasons stated in my written testimony to the Planning Commission, which is in your packet starting on page 228. Briefly, my concerns include protection of neighboring properties, safety for pedestrians and bicyclists, and mitigation of wildlife impacts. However, knowing that it's unlikely that the City Council will deny the rezone, my request tonight is that the Council amend the conditions of approval to provide certainty to neighboring downslope property owners that our homes will be protected from damage and harm. At the Planning Commission hearing, my neighbors and I expressed significant concerns that insufficient detail was provided to show how drainage onto our properties would be controlled. Although a condition of approval was included to ensure that we are notified when the stormwater management plan is submitted to the city, we were told by Chairman Babbitts that we would need to hire engineering experts and a lawyer to sue the developer if we have a problem with the plans. To me, this doesn't seem like a fair outcome. The proposed rezone and subdivision will affect my life and property. I respectfully request that the City Council modify condition number 3. It's stressful for me not knowing what's going to happen and what can be done about it. It seems like all the cards are in the hands of the developer. Mr. Kettler seems like a reputable developer with sincere intentions to do a good job, and I'm glad that he's local. However, once the rezone and subdivision are approved, it could be sold to someone else to develop, which is all the more reason why a better version of condition number 3 is necessary and justified. With City Council's help, I hope that my husband and I will be able to better plan and budget for our future, and that our rights and property values will be respected and preserved. Thank you. That's all I have to say at this time.
Thank you very much. Al and Megan Barton.
This is Megan Barton. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Yeah, so my address, I'm actually share a driveway with Mary King. I'm at 3017 Eugene Street. And I also spoke at the first meeting and expressed some concerns about the proposed drainage, that there was a little bit of confusion about how that would look. And so my husband had actually reached out to the developer, and I think he spoke with Mike to get some more information about that. And it still seems like there's some vagueness associated with that. So obviously we have some concerns. Our unique situation is that we do have a sump pump, different maybe from some other neighbors, that manages some of that water drainage. And so it works quite well. I know other homes in the area do deal with that, but my biggest concern is once there is some of that vegetation removed, there's some egress of water coming into the area. Will that be something that I'm going to have to be responsible for financially, and how will that impact our situation? So I do have still have some concerns about that, and also feel that there is a little bit out of our hands to be able to deal with some of those concerns, and also witnessed sort of the suggestion that we could pay extra money, you know, to be able to get more discovery of documents or information, that we could sue someone, which is obviously not something we want to do. We would just like to have a little bit more information before we would agree that it's a good idea to move forward. And that's all I have to say as well.
Okay. Was your husband going to speak this evening too, Megan?
Unfortunately, he is on an emergency Zoom call right now for work, so he's unable to attend, but I hope to be able to fill him in.
Okay. Okay, great.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. So those were the opposed. So the applicant or the applicant's representative, either Sean or Mike, you have time for rebuttal.
Yeah, first I'll speak to Linda's number one case, which was the diversity of the design. I agree with her. I think diversity of design is significantly needed. The Tanner 1.5 subdivision is something that I think everyone wished went a little smoother and a little better, and we got a little better outcome of design. Tanner 2.0, which is the phase that she spoke of that's about ready to be developed, will have the diversity of design that she speaks about, which leads into her major concern, which was she feels that a single-family, multifamily, mixed-use design is what the city needs in its housing. If you don't approve the R2, that need that she complained as her number one argument for what the city needs can't be completed without changing it to R2. So we could not do multifamily mixed use with single family if you don't move to an R2. Thus, you know, she basically made her point that the R2 zone change is needed for exactly what she thinks the city needs. The second applicant, we've talked to them a couple times, and it is hard for them at this phase. It is kind of a vague concept because they do only get to see kind of a preliminary engineering. And because of the preliminary engineering, the detail in what they gather is a little probably hard to interpret if they don't do it very often, or they don't understand the standards and what, as a developer, we're held to. Sorry. Yeah, so with that said, you know, I think we can assure them that through the engineering standards of Hood River and the state of Oregon, that the zero impact that we will have on their property should give them some security. I think that's why in the Planning Commission, they voted to have us notify them that when our official engineered complete packet is submitted, that they would be notified so they could then see the actual engineering. Also, you know, they should be, I guess, comforted and aware that they don't need to hire an engineer and attorney to sue us. That's why the city has an engineer. It's on behalf of the citizens of the community. So that way, as a developer, we're not doing anything that doesn't meet the city standards or is not up to what the city's needs are. So I think I address their concerns as much as I can with comfort and the fact that we will, you know, try to do a good job, but she's correct. If we disappear and somebody else takes it over, they'll still be held to the same standards that the city has. And then they have, the city has an engineer, which is on behalf of the people, not on our behalf. We'll have our own private engineer, and that engineer will work with the city's engineer to make sure it conforms. So that kind of addresses the things that I heard that are unopposed. I don't know if you, Sean, if you have anything, or if you want anything more from us.
Yeah, it's about Linda's comment about 36 townhouses. Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but as of the plan this morning, we were not building 36 townhouses there.
Correct. The plan is not to do 36 townhouses. Not saying there won't be any townhouses. The lower lots, definitely the northern lots, definitely will not. It won't work to build a duplex or a townhouse because of the lot gradients. So you won't see townhouses on the northern lots. You could maybe see them on some of the southern lots, but with the alleyway access, that also will make pretty, you know, it won't be by any means 24 townhouses either, because it won't fit with the alley access. So, you know, we'd be fortunate and lucky if we could maybe get 4 to 6 in, but, you know, just from at this phase, that's about as far as I could see it.
And what do you project the sale price of these houses will be? Because when we first did this, we turned the application in, we were thinking about 425 to 450. That was a year and a few months ago.
Yeah, when we started, we wanted to be sub 450. My guess would be you're probably going to be plus or minus 500 would be a guess for us to at least make costs plus a small fee. Yeah, I mean, it's all depending on time and the requirements that the engineering come back with. So I would say probably plus or minus 500 would be my guess. But I couldn't be held to that until we're done with time and the actual subdivision.
Okay, anything else, Mike or Sean?
Okay. No, not this time.
If you guys want to hang around, if there's some additional questions from council, thanks. So Dustin, do you want to recap after hearing any of those comments?
Yeah, again, we're here for your questions, Mayor. Again, the request before you is the change from R1 to R2. That is the map change request. It's a quasi-judicial request because it's only for this piece of property. It's not of greater applicability. It's only restricted here. I believe you have one hand up too, by the way. I'm not sure if that's how long that's been waiting around, but just as a public hearing and process, I think we have a Larry Ellifritz. And before I close the public hearing, there may be one more person who wants to speak. Sorry for that.
Okay. All right. If we have one person that wants to speak that didn't get on our list, I don't know if they have a procedural question, but let's let them talk. See if they have a procedural question.
Actually see that they
may. Mr. Fritz, if you wish to talk, please raise your hand again. I noticed you lowered your hand as soon as we addressed it. He has not raised his hand again after taking it down himself, so I am going to assume that he does not need to address the council.
Okay. Sorry for that, Mayor. As a hearing, we want to make sure that we have all our participants and people with our opportunity to speak here. So we do have a unanimous recommendation from Planning Commission. I think some of the concerns that were raised, including the final drainage and final stormwater plan, at this time at the land use stage, typically we do not have final grading and final stormwater plans. Those are reserved and those are required to be reviewed by engineering after this stage. We're looking, and the criteria call for the adequate public facilities analysis. So within the report itself and within the subdivision, there includes a number of findings from our engineering team that reviewed this. Planning Commission also heard this request, and an added condition of approval was submitted stating that at the time of submission, the applicant would be required to notify the neighbors that they had submitted final engineering plans. This is typically outside of what the process entails, but this is a matter of providing some additional transparency to the neighbors so they would be notified when final grading and final stormwater work was submitted. And that is included in your recommended conditions of approval from the Planning Commission. So with that, again, as you deliberate, we'd be happy to discuss with you or answer any questions you may have regarding the application or the record or the packet.
Madam Mayor, I have a few comments too as on the side of staff in this matter. Will that be okay?
Sure, go ahead.
I wanted to briefly respond to some of the testimony that came in this evening, kind of put it in context. In terms of, this is a zone change application and a subdivision. The subdivision just creates lots. It doesn't really dictate what goes on those lots. This isn't a housing development necessarily that's been reviewed and approved. It's just a creation of lots. And so we don't really have a way of dictating duplexes versus single family homes. The traffic analysis that was done was based on just the number of lots being used as single family homes. What the traffic analysis looks at is capacity of affected intersections, and there's a condition that requires them to verify that there's actual capacity for the number of units that they eventually do construct. It's really unlikely that the difference, even if they were to max out at 36 lots, the number of the trip generation differences is negligible between that and 18 lots. The suggestion that the city should require a certain type of design, you can't do that. It has not been allowed under state law to require design review or impose design requirements on needed housing. It hasn't been for decades in this state. So that's not an option. And the testimony about stormwater, I wasn't at the Planning Commission hearing, but I can imagine the statement made by the Planning Commission Chair, Arthur Babbitts, that if there's a problem, they could sue the developer later. The whole subdivision process, it reviews compliance with the stormwater requirements of the city. And those were all engineering requirements, but the basic gist, the fundamental requirement is that the post-development rates of stormwater runoff cannot exceed the pre-development rates of stormwater runoff. So it's basically, you can't change things, what flows off the property. And invariably, when you put in a subdivision with a stormwater collection and treatment and disposal system, it invariably improves stormwater problems on surrounding properties. And so I think Mr. Babbitts, what he was referring to is if they don't comply with, if they end up not building according to the plans or they have some sort of impact that's not anticipated by the plans, then that's something that can be dealt with in civil court later on. But for the Planning Commission's review, they look to the city engineer to verify that the proposal meets or can meet the city's stormwater requirements. So it's not true that the Planning Commission just leaves the neighbors to shift for themselves with regard to stormwater impacts. The Planning Commission's job was to ensure compliance with the stormwater requirements of the city, and they did that. So those are the points that I thought were warranted a review. If anyone has any other questions, I'd be happy to attempt a response.
Okay, thank you. Megan, I'm gonna go ahead and stick around, Dan, and Megan may have a question for you, Dan, but let's just start into deliberations and then the questions can be asked of Dustin, Dan, or the applicant as we get into deliberations. So I'm gonna go ahead and close the public hearing, and so we're now gonna go into deliberations. And we can go with questions first if you'd like to. Megan, did you have a question of someone?
Yeah, I think going on to kind of what Dan was talking about in the first part of his commentary of, you know, this is the zone change and we're not necessarily reviewing the development. Like, where's the line of, I assume once you make a zone change, you know, anything that's allowed under that zone is possible. So whatever Mike Kettler is or is not talking about, like, doesn't necessarily matter, or like
it does.
Okay.
It does matter. And the development, the creation of 18 lots was reviewed. So the internal street system, the stormwater system, provision of public utilities, lot sizes, dimensions, that was all reviewed as part of this development. You know, whether they're duplexes or single family units, that was not, because both are allowed in this zone.
Okay, so like infrastructure matters, but like what may or may not happen on each lot isn't something we would really deal with right tonight.
They have to be residential.
Sorry, yes. Yeah. Within the zone that would be allowed.
Yeah, no rendering plants or anything like that, but you know, okay. Single family or duplexes are allowed in this zone.
You're cutting out a little bit, Dan. I have a question along those same lines as Megan had for Dan, for a clarifying question. So with the traffic, because I know that was an issue, that the traffic analysis was for X amount of dwellings, I think, not X amount of lots. So when the actual number of dwellings is known, there will need to be a pro rata share, depending on what that number is, for some of the bigger intersections. And that won't be determined until we know how many actual units. Is that correct?
Dustin may know better if this is subject to a proportional share evaluation. But in the traffic analysis looked, I think it assumed dwellings, that general match is 10 vehicle trips per day per single family dwelling, and multifamily dwelling units are slightly fewer vehicle trips per day on average. So that was this transportation analysis assumed single family detached 18 detached units, and our Dustin knows better how the conditions were structured. That will require a final reconciliation of trip generation and capacity analysis of the intersections based on what's actually going to be built. So, Dustin?
Dustin, can you answer that question then a little bit clearer?
Yeah, Mayor. We have proportionate shares. So the applicant and the review of this looks at impacted intersections, where the traffic is sent. And when we have intersections that aren't performing to a certain level of service, the applicants aren't necessarily required to fix those intersections of regional impact, but they're required to pay into a proportionate share. So their proportionate impact on them. And this is accounted for in the transportation impact analysis. We did note some internal inconsistencies in that traffic impact analysis. And within your conditions of approval at the time of engineering, they're required to reconcile those and look at the worst case scenario. So we asked them to look at the worst case scenario for proportionate shares, just to be conservative. And that is included in your engineering comments, as well as your conditions of approval. That is a condition of approval. The applicant will reconcile this, these internal inconsistencies, and pay their proportionate share. And that came out of the Planning Commission hearing of the subdivision itself.
Okay. I'm sure there might be a few more questions. Others? Gladys, and then Megan.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I have a couple of questions. So in the packet, this is, I guess, specifically for Mike and Sean. There's a lot of concerns from your neighbors around drainage and the problems that will be caused to them. So how are you willing to collaborate with them? I know that you said you won't know until the actual official packet is complete, but how can you reassure, or how are you reassuring them now that there won't be any drainage issues that they're going to have to be financially responsible for?
Mike, do you want to address that?
Yeah, so the city standard is a no net loss. So the CFS that leaves the property today, we can't increase any amount of CFS that leaves the property. So the drainage concern that they have, we can't aid to it. That's a standard in which we're held to. So I guess our assurance, or how we can comfort them that they won't see any financial risk or future, is that our design that will be approved by the city engineer will take that into account. We can't increase the volume of water leaving the property. So the design will take their lots into account, whether they're homes or you know, multifamily, whatever it is. As we address the zone change today, whatever we get in our density, the design that you'll see will address that.
And what about your neighbors' concerns or about Henderson Creek and the wildlife and the effects or impacts it may possibly have? Have you sought any sort of evaluation from any local group that would help ease any of those concerns?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a good neighboring question, and it is a concern, but this is why we're proposing to develop inside an area that's proposed. There are areas that are designed for habitat. This is why we're developing inside the city limits. This is why we're developing inside the UGB. There are also parks that are designated for this exact reason. So it's why the project that we picked was this project.
But it sounds like there's direct wildlife on the lot itself.
There's nothing that is registered in any of our reports or any of the city reports that this is designated for wildlife. There probably, yes, are squirrels, quails, raccoons, possums, coyotes. I mean, this is a good question. But it's not something that we've addressed in the nature of mitigation. You know, I think as we go to prepare for the subdivision, it'll give the adequate amount of time for the wildlife to move into the, you know, urban areas or rural areas.
So I think, you know, it's been very clear that something along the lines of like multifamily dwellings would be a good idea. Is that something that you are willing to do? And if so, how can you guarantee us? If not, please list your reasons. Would you be willing to split any of these lots? Maybe half of them?
I think if you're asking me as a developer on an R2 lot, would I be willing to...
if it was approved before it's approved, I guess I'm asking, are you willing to meet us halfway, that we know we have a need for housing? Absolutely we do. But the type of housing that you're proposing at this point is very exclusive of the folks that live here in Hood River.
Yeah, sure.
We'll do an R3 if you want.
I was going to say, you give me the zoning, I'll do as small and affordable housing as you want to, if you'd like that to make a condition. So if you'd like to change the zoning, or if you'd like to make, you know, direct requirements to zoning, I mean, make it that we have to provide, you know, 48 homes in R3, and we can, I mean, our stance is yes, we'd love to do as affordable housing as possible. Are we happy with where the outcome comes in these subdivisions? 99% of the time, no, not at all. So meeting you halfway to say, yes, we do R2, I think is a dangerous kind of route to take, because if you make that a requirement, but then that actually creates more cost to a development, you then could potentially raise the price. So now you're taking a townhouse that could be designed for a lower price point, and now you've created a requirement to a subdivision in a zone change. So to get a zone change, you're requiring a condition that potentially could hurt your affordable housing. I would say, I mean, I guess that's a dangerous thing if you want to propose it. I think we would have to take it into account to, you know, think about accepting it. The reason why I would say no now is because at this phase, it's so hard to tell yes or no. I don't think I can give you a definitive answer. I would say, yeah, I'll do 36 if I can do 36 and it's going to bring the price point down. I would guarantee that right now, but I don't think that's something you can guarantee at this phase. So I don't know if that kind of like gave you a full loop circle, but it's not something that I can really answer definitively to help you. Because I think the thing you're asking is, will you help the city to get to affordable housing? My answer is yes, I'd do anything I could. I'd build everything I could there to meet that. But with that lot and that with the requirements that you're going to have to do to create the infrastructure that the city needs, you're not even going to come close to affordable housing, and obtainable housing is a far stretch. So to put a requirement on that, you're just creating a slippery slope that you could actually increase the cost, which is just going to drive the house price up even more. I know it wasn't like a great answer the way you want. I mean, the answer is yes, we'd love to do as much density and the lowest price one house we could, but I don't know if that's the route to get us to get the city there.
I think that some of those questions will come around again when we have the information on the Rand Road property, because that's some of the things that are going to be answered through that process for the Rand Road property.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, regardless, that we need low income to middle income housing, and that's what we don't have at this point. We do not have it. And if we can take two opportunities in an area that are close nearby, and one is specific to low income, the other is middle income housing, we get what our community needs. So this is us trying to, this is me saying we need to collaborate with Mike, with Sean. How can we figure this out? Because we have two tremendous opportunities right now. And one, we're talking about one right now. So how can we make it worth more of the while for all of our community members?
You could make it a condition to do the R2 to take off the CP10 and CP8 capital improvement project that are required right now in the subdivision that'll cost us up to $180,000 to perform. We could take that $180,000 and put it into affordable housing.
What is CP8 and CP10?
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, so the improvements that we have to do to fix the infrastructure inside of City of Hood River. So that's going to be a cost of the cost of development. So, I mean, that's the piece that we're speaking to in this development is it's not just as simple as adding more lots, right? The infrastructure that it takes to build 18 lots is so costly that's the piece that drives the house price up. So, and that's kind of what I was getting at. The more you make a requirement to it, the more you potentially add the risk of increasing the development cost. So I love where your passion is. I love where your head's at, because it's the city's need, but it's sad. And it, you know, it's like Sean said, where we started almost a year and a half ago, when we started the process to do this development, you know, we were trying to be sub 450, which still isn't even obtainable or not even close to affordable. At this point, it's just below the median average, which is the goal. And, you know, And I could lie and say, yeah, we're going to still hit that 450, but I just, you know, at the rate we're going now, I just know we're not going to. So I don't want to tell you that we won't be. So.
And I think, you know, the CP8 and the CP10, now that you've said what they are, you know, those are city requirements. And, you know, those are on the books, that those are required of any developer. And yep. If we have one developer that we're saying, well, you don't have to do it, and the next one does, then that's arbitrary. We can't do that. So the rules we have to follow for changing this to R3 are, you know, the stuff we read today. If we want to do a policy change that says that we would allow that in some instances, if a certain thing is done, then that has to be done through policy, not through a specific land application that we're already in the middle of, that all the people have been noticed about. We can't do it in the middle of that. It has to be through a policy change prior to a developer coming to us. I mean, it's frustrating, but that's how it works.
Yeah, I fully understand that. I was more giving you the narrative to start the discussion of exactly what you just did.
Yeah. Mark?
Okay, questions more than deliberations right now. So I'm pretty sure, Dustin and Dan, that we're approving both the plat and the zone change. I came into this discussion thinking we were doing just the zone change and the plat was FYI, but we're doing both.
It's just the zone. It's just the zone change. The plat is FYI, and it helps put your zone change into perspective.
Gotcha. So like my three questions, and you can tell me whether they're moot, is one, is LID techniques, you know, low impact development being used to help reduce the runoff that you have to put in retention ponds? There's a list of 10 significant trees or tree clusters that are in the packet, and does the plan protect those? I couldn't tell, and I didn't. It just said that one of the conditions is there shall be an inventory, and I see an inventory, but I don't see a shall be protected in here. And then third, just traffic. And I think this is more a question for the city, which is the intersection that I'm most worried about in this is not people going down May to Rand, but people cutting through Eugene to Rand, you know, which is past the most number of small road houses. And just how do we make sure that we squeeze the balloon so that as we add these houses, they scooch in a direction we want them to scooch. And maybe stop signs or something like that can be used to manage that. So of those three questions, are any of them pertinent?
Yeah. Thank you, Councillor. The LID question, we have some LID considerations in there in the street width. So engineering has reviewed the streets based on two configurations. One of them with the statement of, if you want to use the street for stormwater, like we call it, we refer to as a treatment train approach, treat this prior to getting to the pond. There's a different section that's contemplated in it. So it's not a mandate, but it's contemplated from the city side in case we have the opportunity to use it. So it's not a mandate, but it's if you want to use this technique, it's included in some of the frontage requirements.
So permeable pavings, that kind of stuff?
Be more of a stormwater, kind of a water quality in your parkways and your tree lawns. So rather than the turf grass, they look more like, they refer to them as the green streets. You know, they have
not just conveyance through a pipe. Yeah.
Right. That is not a mandate, but that's been opened up for discussion. So one aspect of that, with the use of the internal alley system that is contemplated, you actually have a long uninterrupted frontage piece that can be used rather than a series of six driveways, each that eat up 26 feet of your parkway. By the use of the rear loaded product, you actually have some usable space, but That will also be determined in final engineering. But we've thought about it, and it's built in as an option. As far as the trees, you have a tree inventory in your packet provided by Tyler Roth. There's really the only significant trees that showed up are along the 30th front edge, and most of those will be removed minus a ponderosa pine, or excuse me, a Doug fir. I think there's about 10 of them that need to be removed. And those are for street improvements that the applicant gets to construct for the frontage of 30th. There's a number of trees on there that are identified as invasive species, which have been identified to be removed, and their arborist is stated of little value.
No, right. To me, there's just a couple really large oaks in that list, or relatively large oaks, a 21 inch and a 20 inch and a, and are, is everything in that table a goner? Is that the answer?
Minus the Doug fir. The largest, the single Doug fir, the rest we expect to be removed.
The ponderosa pine you're talking about. Because I don't even see a Doug fir.
Conifer. Yeah, ponderosa pine.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad. Okay. And it's something that we're making them take out to put in sidewalks. Is that the deal?
Yeah. These are public improvements that will go in on 30th Street. So sidewalks, curb, gutter, detention, stormwater conveyance. All really not so much in the way of development, but infrastructure for development.
Right. And we can't make the sidewalk go around a big tree. Is that the cost of progress? It sounds like.
Certainly, we want to save them when possible. It's the difficulty comes when this is kind of an infill piece, and they are working with a little bit of a street grid, which kind of goes into traffic, the next one. But yeah, there has been really no, we didn't see, or engineering didn't identify a way to save this. I'm sure the developer would probably agree to save them, and if at all possible.
I guess, I don't know why we asked to do inventory and then it doesn't matter. I'd love to see cleverness in getting around these things. And if that means wiggling a sidewalk a little bit or getting rid of a street strip for 20 feet, I think that that's this is my opinion, obviously, it is a worthy trade-off in some cases. So, but that's not for here. So I think that's all three of them then, right? And then traffic was the third point.
Yeah. As far as traffic layout, they do, when they analyze their trip generation, they look at which direction all these trips go. Part of our request here in the look was to line the street grid up, continue the street grid. I didn't see any offsite improvements that had to do with unique stop signs that show up in any particular location, but as far as the street alignment, these are, Prospect and Eugene were streets that really they're local streets that we supported their continuation in their current configuration as they line up.
I'm also certain that they don't trip any quantity, volume stuff, but I noticed that neither of those intersections on Rand were the ones reviewed in the document. So, they're looking at a gross traffic level thing, and that makes sense, and I agree 100% that they aren't violating any numbers, but there's a difference between May is a arterial, is that the right street, where the other ones are neighborhood streets, and we should try to squeeze them onto the arterial, and this doesn't have to do with the plat really, it's the, how do we squeeze the balloon around it. So Um, That was it, Mayor.
Okay, so I'm going to go to Megan. Had her hand up earlier, I believe. Is that? Did you have a question, Megan? Okay, and then Gladys has another question. I saw her hand up, and then we're going to go to Tim, and then Jessica. Okay, Eric and Jessica. So let's do Megan, Gladys, Tim.
Thanks, Mayor. Well, I guess one, I have a weird memory when I was reading these 250 pages that there was some part of one of the documents that did talk about a traffic analysis at the 36 lots. And I, of course, can't find it now, but like, is that, was there some add-on done or am I just completely crazy?
There's a couple inconsistencies. There is a request that talks about the 18 lot subdivision estimated for duplexes. So okay. That does show up in the traffic impact analysis. There's just some discrepancies within it. So okay. It completely overlooked.
Okay, but they will have to do a fuller one with the assumption of duplexes to meet the current condition?
Not necessarily duplexes, but it's referred to as the worst case scenario. So there is a possibility, you know, whether it's duplexes or whether it's single family, their worst case scenario has to be worked out, and they will be, they have to make their compensation to proportionate shares based on that.
Okay. Well, thank you. And then two other things with like the right-of-way improvements and other infrastructure. So, you know, storm water, sewer, are things being built to a larger size because it's going to potentially R2 versus R1, or would like, you know, the 8-inch pipe still have to be 8 inches, and would the right-of-way still have to be the 50 feet, or I forget the actual size, 60 feet, or does that change with the zone change?
We look at the adequate public facilities. I'm assuming this is for me. Sorry, I jumped in on this.
Whoever can answer it.
We look at the adequate public facilities based on the lot change and based on the outcome. So really, as far as water and sewer lines, there's really no change from R1 to R2 in this instance. Our water lines oftentimes are based for fire flow. The sewer lines are also a minimum size, which is not an issue. The improvements become required because the existing infrastructure that has been in place now is not adequate. So it shows up in your capital improvement plan already for R1. And it really doesn't incrementally grow because it goes from R1 to R2. The conversation for affordability and efficiency would be, it actually becomes less per unit, the more units you add onto it, because the streets are local streets. They're local width. They don't grow in size because they're all of a sudden become R2 streets. Now, if we saw a need for a capacity increase, that would trigger it. But typically going from R1 to R2 doesn't change water, sewer, storm rates, or the frontage requirements.
Okay. So things like the, you know, the 30th right-of-way requirements, that would be required with any change on this property?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
not even zone change, just subdivision improvement in general. Right. 30th has inadequate infrastructure and size. It needs to be updated. It doesn't need to be, the zone change doesn't trigger that. It's really the development.
Okay, thank you. And then last thing, and I might again be reading this plan super wrong, but it was the overflow of the storm facilities was gonna run to Henderson Creek, but through someone else's property. Is that an easement thing, or how does that work? Or did I just read that plan really badly?
No, that's a correct reading. There is an easement provided from that property that we required right away, that if the, as the sewer storm water was discharged in that direction, we needed to see an easement in place now. Otherwise the stormwater plan doesn't work. So we have seen an easement, and that's included, I believe within the packet. So okay. We do have an easement across that private property, neighboring property between this detention pond and proposed detention pond and Henderson Creek.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, Dustin.
Yeah, I'm asking this because I truly don't know, Dustin, what is preventing us going from R1 to R3?
That wasn't the request. So at this point, I've only evaluated the applicant's request to go from R1 to R2. So if we were to evaluate an R1 to R3 request, we would need to disclose that right away. So when it came to Planning Commission evaluating this, I would need to look at that. And then we would need to, it would just be a matter of process. So at this point, we haven't notified any of the neighbors of that request. And that's not what the applicant asked for. So that's really kind of how that would work, is if the request came in to go to R3, we would provide notice that was the nature of the request, and we would advertise that. And we would then evaluate it based on, okay, what are we getting for R3? Our worst case scenario would probably change, and some of our development assumptions would change with this.
Well, I think you clearly heard, I'll build it if it's an R3. So I'm just legitimately asking, what is it going to take for us to get to that point? And does that mean that we start from scratch? I mean, I don't know. I'm just legitimately asking because I don't know.
Yeah, that would be a different request. I would start over. If we wanted to go to R3, I would make a recommendation that we would have to provide notice to the neighbors that this is an R3 change. I would ask the applicant to do their analysis based on the worst case, redo their transportation impact analysis. The TPR findings that are in there, I would ask them to, and that's transportation planning rule, sorry. I would ask them to revise those, and we would go from there. So that's kind of a question that we want to start with from the beginning, is what is your request, applicant? What is your plan? So.
Mm-hmm. Sean and Mike, sorry, I didn't see you for a sec. Is that something that you'd be willing to do?
I think the reason why we didn't do R3 at the beginning was, if you look at, I don't know if you can see my screen. If it comes up, I don't know if it'll share in the piece. But an R3, there's nothing around in an R3. This is the piece we're talking about rezoning. An R3 would felt with our, our legal advice that was given to us on our behalf, that R3 would be a bit of a stretch for the city to prove back at the planning. And so we were nervous that it would have been turned down. So we tried to match and meet the existing neighborhoods. So we tried to take it as far as we could within the confines of what has already been approved by the city.
So your limitation, the limitation or the barrier or the concern was that the city would oppose an R3.
That the city wouldn't be able to find it. I guess the term, I'm searching for the term here.
Find it. What does that mean?
Adequate public facilities to allow it.
Or not even allow it, but this might not be the right term, but that it would feel like a spot zone versus consistent zoning. And so Dustin might help me out with the language that I'm trying to pick apart here.
Well, it's just not typical to have an R3 zone in between an R1 and an R2. And look at the pushback we're getting already, just trying to get it zoned the same as the neighbors that are opposing it. So R3, that's a bigger stretch.
Yeah, I mean, it basically just felt like a bigger risk that would have been harder to prove that it's a needed zone change and it complies with arts already around the area and the zoning.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was going to go on to Tim. Are you done, Gladys? I just want to make sure. Okay. Tim?
Thanks, Mayor. In fact, the last discussion about the consistency with the surrounding areas was one of the things that I was going to try to point out. And Dustin, can you just kind of clarify why that's important in the context of this exercise?
I'm sorry, context in the...
Of the consistency with the zoning to other adjacent areas. And what goes into that?
So in the... And go to the criteria, looking at so the spot zone aspect that Mike mentioned, the idea that we have looked at surrounding zones which are developed and the kind of what's referred to as the natural progression and direction
help provide that context in this application. The fact that the developed area is to the north and to the east is also zoned R2. The lots that are being created are generally of the same size. The street configurations are generally aligned with the existing configurations. Those are things that we discuss by way of zone change and in compatibility. So that's kind of listed into the findings by way of this doesn't become detrimental to the zone change doesn't become detrimental somehow to the surrounding properties or its their abilities as well.
Right. How it affects their property values, is that taken into consideration?
There's a statement in there regarding urbanized land and protection of property values. That is kind of a little bit archaic because I don't think anyone is, you know, and I think we mentioned that the properties have generally, as they've developed, increased in value and so have surrounding properties. So our Hood River context in that respect is, you know, very little has happened to decrease property values regardless of development. So I think that kind of goes into our affordable housing conversation as well.
So in the packet, there seems to be a lot of attention paid to how these streets line up. And that the continuation and the how they actually are continuing, that's a good thing. So does that, and I'm trying to figure it out myself, is that like a plat characteristic or is it a zoning characteristic?
That's definitely one of the plat characteristics. You know, as the recommendation from Planning Commission includes the approval of the subdivision and the block length really, the public right-of-way becomes like the hallmark of the subdivision. You know, the alignment of the streets, that grid street pattern, it also provides the opportunity for our water and sewer improvements, the circulation type. So really when it comes to subdivision, as we mentioned, we're not talking about the final development. That is why the streets become so important. They become important in terms of organizing the block, organizing the circulation, providing the venue for our water, sewer, and capital improvement facilities to align. So they become rather important. So it's the public domain. So
in that respect, I mean, are we, you know, is that kind of implicit in the zone approval that plat characteristic will be carried forward?
Yes. Yeah, this subdivision approval is contingent on the zoning change. So, you know, without the zone change, really some of the characteristics of the plat don't continue. Also, when it comes to some of these things, you know, the idea that we want to make sure that our developments do embody some of these zone changes, and oftentimes it's easier to evaluate that based upon the subdivision that comes before it, rather than zoning purely on speculation.
All right. So can you just briefly talk about the alley that's proposed and the benefits of that?
So this is something we talked about from pre-app with the applicant, and then actually shows up in the neighborhood framework plan from the west side. It talks about pedestrian friendly streets. This development has an alley loaded or a private alley that's included in the rear. It provides an opportunity for the houses on the southern sides to be rear accessed. It provides the opportunity for the houses to go forward without a limited or with fewer breaks as far as front loading driveways. I think I mentioned that in terms of stormwater management. It's also one of the hallmarks of traditional neighborhood design that pushes the house forward towards the street. And that also complies really with a short block, which we see a short block here, and the grid street pattern. These are all traditional neighborhood elements. So having some of those rear access really takes some of the cuts off the street. It also provides a greater opportunity for guest parking on the street rather than what we see now when we have consecutive curb cuts. It really loses the opportunity for any overflow parking or guest parking out front. So that's really some of the hallmarks to the design. And then providing that near the the rear provides that rear access. And I think that's one of the more honorable urban design elements of the project and something we push the developer to do. So, you know, we have to kind of take responsibility. We encourage them to consider an alternative load to reduce the auto centric frontages and push that to the rear.
Yeah, thanks for that. I do want to do a go back to the stormwater runoff issue and try to address the concerns. I mean, obviously, I think that the argument that there's no net increase in the water coming off the property is kind of applicable, but not entirely applicable. Obviously, you can have the same amount of water come off in a very different way in a development. And so to what extent does the grading plan and where does the grading plan come in and how does that affect the potential impacts on the neighboring properties?
You want me to talk about this one or I can
do. Yeah.
For us, the grading plan is included, a preliminary grading plan is included as a part of the preliminary subdivision. Mm-hmm. It's also evaluated for general design, for general facilities, because stormwater is one of our, is one of our public facilities that we look at. When we look at the preliminary plans, it's not just a no net increase. It also has to be limited by water quality and the amount, not just the amount that's released, but the rate in which it's released. We have seen some modernization in our stormwater management plans to address pre-development conditions. So now we're not looking at this site as pre-development and its current status. Pre-development actually predates this area. And so we will evaluate, or our engineers will evaluate the characteristics and traditional flows of the water prior to its current status. They will look at release rates and how much volume is basically diverted to a stormwater detention pond and the rate in which it's released off the site. So though there's no guarantee that the neighbor's water issue will improve, this certainly is the expectation is that this development will not make it worse. It cannot make it worse by following the engineering standards. So there is also the idea that adequate public facilities and protecting neighborhood properties are synonymous with following our stormwater design laws and regulations that our professional engineering, very, you know, capable and technical smart staff evaluate after the preliminary is approved. So we don't get all the answers now, but certainly we need to demonstrate some level and anticipation that those high level technical reviews can be completed and can be done in context of this kind of very somewhat high level development and land use analysis.
Yeah, thank you. I guess my final question is, you go through the process of making sure that it doesn't conflict with any of the comprehensive plan elements. And I came to goal 6, air, water, and land resources quality. And then it seems to make the argument that because it's a residential use, that maybe it's not applicable some way. And please clarify this. And then it goes through that it will not create any industrial emissions. And I guess the example that comes to mind for me is that if you put if every one of those units has like a wood stove, is that something that's ever considered with respect to affecting air quality? Or is it really strictly just an industrial issue?
So in the goal 6, the anticipation is that we will see somewhat conventional impacts from residential. So as long as we permit the wood stove allowance, we should anticipate some general use of it. So that would be something that we wouldn't hold the development to a greater standard other than what we have now. Somewhat in our code and the way that it's analyzed is as long as there administering their request and they're complying with the zoning code, the zoning code should be complete in enforcing the provisions of the comp plan. So that's, you know, in order to address the comp plan, we enforce the zoning code. And so there, if we had a request in our zoning code that says, you know, you must prohibit these uses, that should be really explicit in our zoning code. So for them to follow suit, we wouldn't look at that. We wouldn't look at anything that was unconventional or, you know, holding them to a higher standard than a typical residential use.
I guess I'm not, you know, I accept that for this particular hearing. I question, whether that's a good standard or not. Maybe that's something we should think about. Because it kind of seems like if you were an industrial use and it was permitted, you could have an industrial plant spewing. Spewing pollution into the air, and you would have to deal with that somehow. So the difference between that and a residential use is a little bit lost on me. But anyways, that's kind of just my last question, and just more of a general question about how those criteria are applied. So thank you very much, Dustin.
All right, Eric, and then Jessica.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, everyone. I did have a few questions, and I guess I'll start with the question Mark asked, because I may have misheard or misunderstood, but I thought I heard different answers from Dan and Dustin. We are both reviewing the zone change and the subdivision, correct?
No, just this request is just for the zone change. The subdivision was approved by Planning Commission. It was not appealed. But obviously, typically it's easier to look at this in context of a subdivision. So the only request for council is to consider the R1 to R2 request.
Okay. And that you agree with that, Dan?
Yes. The development is going to be the subdivision that's before you. I mean, it's been approved. It hasn't been appealed. This comes to you because all zone changes have to, but the subdivision is contingent upon the zone change.
Okay.
So they're tied together and they're both approved at the same time. The zone change has to go through this final step, but this is the development that will be on this property. This Planning Commission created these 18 lots.
So if I or anyone else were to try to spend energy looking at the conditions for approval, that's misspent because that's not on the table tonight, correct?
Right. I think the conditions all pertain to the subdivision.
Okay. That's good to know. To me, it's a much easier question to approve the lot change, particularly given all those R2s that are surrounding this particular property. But I had Mary King made a point about, well, could we add language somewhere? She was one of the people that spoke to bolster point number 3. And point number 8, and I pointing out point number 18, because I've heard some concern talk tonight about the stormwater discharge, and we are going to have impervious surfaces, so there is a likelihood that it will discharge differently than it does today, and we're putting at risk these neighboring folks. So having some stronger language in there might be a good idea, but I guess it's why should I even be talking about that if it's not on the table, correct?
That's true. Those aren't relevant to the zone change, but also it's not just that the water is collected and shot off site. There's detention, there's water quality controls as well. So there is a stormwater system that has been proposed and will be constructed. And it's just the overflow from the detention, as I understand it, that goes over this easement to the nearby creek. So So it isn't just going to be shedding all the impervious surfaces off to the adjoining properties. There is a collection, detention, and treatment system in this.
Sure. Yeah, and I was frankly attracted to Mary King's comment about some stronger language, because the only mandatory language about compliance I saw was an 18, that the applicant shall conduct adequate stormwater infrastructure per a local stormwater master plan. And, you know, it's easy for me to just sit here and flyspeck this, but, you know, something adding about and other governing law or something. But again, I think it's not on the table, so I think I'm just going to move on. I did want to ask a clarifying question, because one of the points that Linda Maddox had made, which I thought was a fair point, that because there was talk and there initially during the presentation that this is 18 parcels, but if they're duplexes, 18 times 2 is 36. And then in rebuttal, I think Mike, sorry, I'm using your first name, Mike Kettler, I believe, Mr. Kettler, made the point that, well, we're never going to put 36 townhomes. But that seemed to change from units to townhomes, because I don't think Linda Maddox was concerned about townhomes. So I guess my question to Mr. Kettler is, if this is approved R2, and it would be 36 units, it's even if they're not townhomes, it still could be 36 units, correct? And that's a two-part question. And my question is, do you agree with Dan Kern's comment that there would not be any material difference in the traffic analysis had the traffic analysis been done at 36 rather than 18?
Yes, so you are correct. I did say townhouses and units. So R2 allows for a duplex that through Hood River Municipal Code that can be turned into a townhouse. So I guess I'll restate it. I think this is the answer to your question you're looking for is, yeah, you would not see 36 units. So it couldn't support, in my most professional developing experience, you couldn't support 36 units on the proposed 18 lots. So that hopefully answers your one. And two, yeah, the traffic analysis is done on the worst case scenario. So it's done based upon the zoning for R2. And then that's why you see a little bit of the contradicting language of where 36 units appeals partially in it, but it speaks to the 18 lots done based upon R2 zoning. So you would not see an increase if you were to shift in units built. Now, Dustin, you might have to correct me there. You could interpret that at the time of the partition of the townhouse, that would then become in question, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, at this time, it's based upon the worst case scenario for the zoning and the lots required or lots requested.
Okay, thank you for the answer. And my last question is, I guess it's to the subdivision, but if you'll indulge the question anyway, and I didn't see it referenced, I apologize if I missed it, but is there, are there any conditions of approval or infrastructure items associated with the question of whether there will be street lights through this subdivision?
Yeah, I could be misquoted, but I think the city standard is every 300 feet per intersection is streetlight required. That gets sussed out in the engineering phase to actually define how many they'll require. My guess is you'd probably see 3 to 4 in this subdivision would be a guess, but that's sussed at the application and public works for engineering.
Okay, but there would be some because there were some, and this is a lot, I'm showing my age, but when the Summit View project went in, and that might have been county, not city, there were just no street lights, and people are complaining about that every once in a while, still to today. So I'm just, but I'm hearing you say that there will be street lights in this subdivision.
Correct.
So yes, the engineering will make us put them in. They'll tell us where to put them and everything.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Okay. Just to clarify, Summit View, the residents requested no lights, but they had to put the infrastructure under the street that could be added in later.
Yeah. I was a resident. I didn't get a vote, but that's okay. I'm not challenging there, Mayor.
Weird way that happened. Anyway, Jessica.
Thank you, Mayor. Everybody's questions were very thorough. I understand that this is really discussing whether we've met the conditions to go from R1 to R2. I don't have any more questions about that question right now.
Okay. All the questions I had have been answered. All the counselors have asked all the questions I was going to ask. I was going to ask about traffic analysis. I was going to ask a little bit more about stormwater. But everything I had that I had a question about has already been asked and answered. So I'm personally comfortable with this being changed from R1 to R2 with those questions being answered. And so more discussion. I mean, we've all been asking a lot of questions. No one's basically kind of said, Jessica's kind of said she's comfortable. Let's just kind of go straw poll and people give their opinion. Are you comfortable? And then if we are comfortable with one thing or another, we can go with the motion. So Jessica and I have both given our opinion. Megan?
I think, you know, our housing needs analysis or strategy identifies increasing the efficient use of our residential land as a need going forward. And I think obviously the shift from R1 to R2 would do that kind of by definition. I know it's a bummer it's not more affordable, but I think increasing the efficiency of this land kind of opens up other residential land to be more available with limited residential land levels. So I think the conditions have been met and I'm comfortable with the zone change.
Mark?
Yeah, given that the R2 extends to the north and to the east from here, and it fits in with what's been being built down there, I'm supportive of this zone change. It feels to fit, and I think that that's the criteria that we're being asked to look at. I would, in sort of addressing Gladys's questions, you know, we've talked about getting to the point where we discuss a set of carrots to incent development for, you know, that can get to attainable, affordable. I think that we're just, as a policy setting thing, we're just not quite there, and these applications have to come through in their time. So I am supportive of the zone change.
Gladys?
I think you all can tell that I'm frustrated, but we are being asked specifically from R1 to R2. And I think I've raised my concerns, and I do feel comfortable with R1 to R2.
Thank you. Tim?
Yeah, I'm comfortable. I'm comfortable with the zone change as well, but I think as Mark is indicating and as Gladys is indicating, if we can somehow have further discussions on any potential policy changes that would get us more towards affordable or attainable housing, that would be great.
And Eric?
Yes, Mayor, I am sitting in, I did understand this to be quasi-judicial, so I'm viewing my role as listening to the facts and trying to apply the standards. My conclusion is that the applicant has met the applicable standards. That map that Mr. Kettler had up, which was this map, speaks volumes because it is surrounded by R2. And so I think the developer has done its job. I will say that the comments from Linda Maddox and Mary King resonated with me. And this does appear, and I think the minutes should reflect not only from the questions and answers, but from the applicant himself, that this will not be 36 units, at least under the current vision, because that could possibly impact the traffic flow, but I heard him say it wouldn't be that many. And I like Mary King's point about having stronger language in terms of the conditions of approval. Well, that just wasn't before me or us, so I feel like I can't venture off there. So I will be voting in favor of the zone change.
Jessica?
I was just going to say that along the lines of carrots, I was looking I think that the Rand Road development is going to be, you know, reading through Leland's proposal will be an opportunity for us to really look at what some of the incentives could be like for future developments.
Yeah, I hope our process through that will be able to come up with some more carrots for that. Does anyone want to make a motion? There is a motion on page 5 of the packet.
I move to approve file 2020-13, adopting planning commission findings, recommendations, and conditions.
I have a motion from Megan.
I'll second it.
Tim got it.
Tim seconded that motion for file 2020-13 to change the zoning from R1 to R2. Additional discussion? Roll call vote, Megan?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Tim?
Yes.
Eric?
Aye.
Jessica?
Aye.
Gladys?
Yes.
And the chair votes aye. All right. Let's take a 5-minute recess. It's and come back about 2 minutes after 8.
Mayor, can I just briefly, I did want to clarify Pamela Larson's intent with her testimony prior to this. I did want to clarify that gathering is actually invitation only. It's not meant for to gather a whole bunch of people together. So I just wanted to.
I didn't understand it to be that way. I didn't know that was what she was saying. So, yeah. You know, for a fact that is what she was trying to do is invite council. Then thank you for making that clear.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, 5 minutes.
Howdy.
Oh, there you are, jumping around on my screen. Okay. Let's see here. I guess we're ready. It is about 3 minutes after 8, and we're going to call the meeting back into session, and we're going to head and open the work session. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
No, Mayor, we do not.
Okay. Discussion item of extension of certain provisions for COVID assistance. Will and Dustin.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to get a screen share going here, and we're going to tag team this. Maybe not. All right. Can you guys hear me and see this? All right, great. Thank you. So over the past 8 months, the city has partnered with a number of our local stakeholders and agencies to really provide some support strategies during the COVID-19 pandemic. Some of these responses focused on the business community and our customers, including a pilot program that allowed for use of public property and some flexibility in how we administered some of our licensing. The opportunity and many of those strategies really focused on some seasonal uses, and it allowed the community to take advantage of our summer weather for both business purposes as well as customers, and really to take advantage of that seasonal rush and capture the good weather that we are so fortunate to have here. In addition to the business support, we also provided a number of support to individuals
really through utility installs or utility payments. You saw us provide some project management for the homeless shelter and really use the emergency declaration to try to provide some flexibility in how we responded to the pandemic. The purpose of tonight's agenda item is to review some of these programs and the immediate responses and to gather feedback to inform some longer term adaptations that are going to be necessary to respond to the pandemic until we see some level of resolution. And really to kick things off, as I mentioned, some of our business responses included the use of the parklets. We were able to really try to be agile and provide some expedited right-of-way permits. We also used, again, some of our parks to allow businesses to host events there. Now, this is kind of an unconventional use of public property, but really something that we found and you all found necessary during the pandemic. And as you can see, the city is now receiving requests such as the one that Lorraine Lyons raised earlier is to start focusing our attention further down the road on how do we either employ these to take an audit of how did they work and what do we want to do coming into the future as we settle into trying to operate under the current pandemic conditions. There was also the series of support for individuals and Will, I'm going to pass the baton to him, really led a lot of these efforts and kind of spearheaded some of the financial assistance that was made available outside the business community.
Thank you, Dustin. So we passed through 100% of our CARES, Federal CARES Act funding for utility assistance to individuals, making $300 individual grants, homeless assistance to the warming shelter, nonprofit assistance through the United Way, childcare assistance through childcare partners out of CGCC, and then also direct support to the Chamber of Commerce. We just got the last of those checks out last week, so we're fully expended, but it's too early to report back on the outcomes of that funding. However, it's not too early to be thinking about what metrics and how we want to decide if we were to get more allocation of CARES funding. Our understanding from the League of Oregon Cities is, as a whole, cities have only spent about 35% of their CARES Act monies because it had to be on a reimbursement basis. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that as an entity that has shown that we can put this money to work, that maybe we could get a larger proportion of it. The other aspect of our financial response has been through the emergency declaration that suspended all penalties, interest, fees related to non-payment of any city bills, and that include ending water shutoffs for a period of time. All of those financial aspects of the emergency declaration will continue on for an additional 60 days after the emergency declaration expired, which was on September 30th. So everyone has a grace period until the beginning of December. So we're still waiving penalties, interest, and fees. We've put the notice out to all the people who have accumulated balances and also to property owners whose tenants have accumulated balances. And we've administratively decided to continue to waive any payment plan fees for the rest of 2020 to encourage people not to allow this to go to collections and to start accruing interest and penalties, and instead make contact with us and set up a payment plan if they need to. One other item that, as we could settle into a more normal operating environment, but still cognizant of COVID-19 and its continuing impacts, is bring forward to the City Council an ordinance to consider providing staff with more discretion on when to perform water shutoffs. Right now, the municipal code says that we shall cut off and discontinue service after 2 months of non-payment. And what we wanna bring forth to the council is something that provides a little bit more flexibility to staff for your consideration and discussion at a future meeting
I would say when the city manager sees a crisis situation or ongoing need for flexibility and payment options, that we would have the discretion to set up alternative rules rather than the strict discontinuation of water service after 2 months. So those are some previews of coming attractions of what we'll bring to you. I'll pass it back over to Dustin.
All right, thanks, Will. My compadres are going to get me for putting too many words on this slide, too small a font, but this is what's coming up next, and thankfully we have a lot of words to share, but it also kind of demonstrates the need of what we see out there. So this is a preview of some of the next steps that are coming up on some of these programs, and we're looking to make sure that council is comfortable with this and has some support for us to continue to invest our time on this and hear any feedback you have on this early stage of whether this is worth your staff resource while. Most of these have built into them some return to council to provide you updates, but I'm just gonna run through them while you read. The first one, as been mentioned, is participation with the chamber in a working group. We're now getting into the shoulder season and past. So now that we don't have the opportunity to use some of our outside environmental resources, we're gonna be working with the chamber to discuss some, what does some winter support look like? And using them as a liaison to our business community. So we've already been in contact with the chamber and they're going to send out some invitations for us to participate as a stakeholder. And how do we formulate some strategies? The next, this kind of goes back to public comment, the creation of a working group to evaluate the parklet program, what worked, what didn't work, what needs to change. And this is really based on some of the pilot program that we did before and whether we want to, and if we're gonna be able to continue to use these in the future. We're looking for the use of some of our licensing flexibility. That was done this year, really fixed and focused on some of the food carts. A lot of our food carts, well, all of our food carts, every time they relocate, the health authority has to go back out and reassess them. At this time, although we don't have any compliance issues, it was a matter of, given the pandemic, did we want to continue to rely and push the health authorities' limited bandwidth and resources on food cart reestablishments every 6 months, or was there an opportunity that we could safely administer that without having the health authority focus on other things? And that will also come back for some consideration. We also want to consider the use of the parking spaces for pickup and drop off. This was part of the program that we allowed on-street parking to be used for commercial business pickup zones, kind of like a loading zone, but for customers. That was also part of the pilot program that came through with the parklets. We want to continue to use the availability of the parks for profit activities. You've seen yoga classes, exercise classes, and youth activities occur here, allowing some social distance opportunities at the parks. Again, that was less than conventional, but something that was a response to pretty unprecedented circumstance that we are now. And we're looking for council's consideration of an ordinance to modify the municipal code Title 12, which requires the discontinuation. And this is the one that Will mentioned, providing a little discretion to water shutoffs as compared to what's required by the code now. So this is kind of our laundry list and inclusive menu that we expect to pursue. So we're looking for any consent, any feedback on this list as we move forward.
Great, Dustin. Thank you for bringing all this to us. You know, we're still in COVID and we still need to be thinking about how we can help our community. So this is a great list of things that potentially can help. We still have a long discussion ahead of us with a lot of more items this evening. I guess my if anyone has a concern and doesn't like these items or one of these items for a particular reason and thinks we really shouldn't be considering it at all, let's discuss that. And if you are okay with these in general and you don't would like to discuss these and have them brought forward to us, we don't need to go into them in great detail right now if people are okay with that. So I just ask for people, and I can't see everyone on my screen right now. Okay, I'm trying to look at everyone at the same time here. Megan, looks like you might have your hand up. Is that true? Okay, and let's Megan comment and then Mark.
Okay, thanks, Kate. So I like all of these. I think they're great. I'm wondering if we, when we're looking at the non-payment flexibility, if we can also include like the penalties, interest, and fees, given, you know, I'm hoping the utility assistance we're providing is addressing some of that, but like given this is a long-term significant economic hardship for a lot of folks, I'd like to include that if possible.
Mark?
Sorry, I was still muted. So is the first one, the working group of food and beverage, does that help us define how we can help businesses if there's new CARES Act money? Because that came up before, and I think it's a good topic, but I don't know if this is that.
I'll jump in here. My understanding is that the chamber would plan to have Small Business Administration there. And I think what Will was referring to is specifically the CARES money that's been allocated so far. So we do not have anything, you know, other than the feedback that you've given us so far related to that. So that's a good question, Counselor, and something we could certainly add if it looks like we'll be getting additional CARES.
Yeah, I'd like to add it just to be prepared, because in the last discussion, we weren't able to get around what a helpful business aid plan would be if we had another $100,000 or $200,000. So I'd suggest we add that too. I think that these are generally right on. I do like the 6 month rotation of food carts in a healthy time. I think that, you know, it prevents it from being long-term competition with brick and mortar places. And I've bought from all of them and I don't think they mind, but I am sensitive to the, you know, are we really asking county health to go out and do this? So not forcing them to move around seems like it makes perfect sense to me in the interim. And then for the non-shutoff stuff, I think this is fine. I would be supportive of even something just extending non-payment until, you know, through the winter, until April kind of thing is fine by me. But if this gives city manager the tools to do it on a case-by-case basis, and if you guys think that's better, I'm hip to that. And then I'm super supportive of parklets, and if you're looking for council people on a working group, I volunteer for that. So
thanks, Mark. Jessica?
I was just gonna, along the lines, I like all these ideas. I didn't really have anything to add. I appreciate staff bringing them. But along the lines of if we got additional CARES money, I was just remembering how we had shortchanged the city a little bit in the last discussion, and I think we'd want to make sure the city's covering what we need to, and if there's any kind of strategic, you know, replacement of IT infrastructure, things that we could tie to COVID. I'm sure you guys are thinking creatively. So, but thank you for these ideas.
Great. Anyone else? Gladys?
I just want to make a comment that I love all these ideas. I agree with Mark's point of adding additional CARES funds. And I too was going to offer if there's an opportunity for myself to join a working group to work with these, with the chamber or with businesses, that I'd be happy to volunteer my time to do so.
Thank you. Anyone, Tim or Eric, anything else? Or are you good with these?
It's a great list, Mayor. I know there's been some concern about how can we help facilitate these parklets through the winter. People are talking about roofs, and I understand there may be some safety issues and concerns with that. And I'm not in the know with respect to any of that, but just would be encouraging, like I heard Mark say and some others, of the parklets continuing as best we possibly can through the winter.
Councilors, I'm happy to address that, Mayor, if it's all right. Because this question has come up. There's two main issues. One is the ability to plow snow. We really cannot plow snow with those in the right of way without significant risk of damaging them. And it just makes snow plowing operations very difficult. Same concern for ice on the roadway. And second, if these become permanent structures, then we have to look at them differently. We have to go through a permitting process. We would have to go through a building code process. So some pretty major hurdles there that would just require some more time to deal with. So certainly something that we can look at as we get a working group together and we get a better understanding from both the community and council what type of improvements you would prefer to see in the right way.
Great. Thank you. So I think you guys you've gotten head nods on everything with a few comments and a few additions, and I love the comments everyone made. You guys are making my job easy because you come up with all the questions before it gets to me. So thank you so much, the rest of council. And so I think that's great. Go forth and bring them back. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mayor. We appreciate the comments and your spirit of volunteerism. So we'll be back soon enough.
Okay. All right. We will adjourn the work session and we'll go into the regular council meeting. And open the regular council meeting at 8:23. Any agenda additions or corrections?
No, Mayor, there are none.
Okay. So we have a consent agenda, which has council meeting minutes from two different dates, OLCC permit from two businesses, and the purchase of a truck and a street sweeper. Does anyone need to have questions or want to pull their name off? Jessica?
Could we maybe separate out the OLCC permit for Slopeswell? That's a business my husband and his partners own, and so I can vote on the rest of the consent agenda and then recuse myself from that one.
Sure, let's do that. Anyone else have anything on the consent agenda? All right, if I could get a motion on the consent agenda without the Slopeswell OLCC permit on it.
I move that we approve the consent agenda without the Slopeswell OLCC permit.
I'll second.
We have a motion from Jessica and a second from Megan to approve the consent agenda without the Slopeswell OLCC permit application. Roll call vote. Jessica?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Vadas?
Aye.
Megan?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Eric?
Aye.
And chair votes aye. All right. And then a motion on the OLCC permit for Slopeswell.
I will move that we approve the OLCC permit for Slopeswell.
I second.
We have a motion from Megan and a second from Gladys to approve the OLCC permit application from Slopeswell. Roll call vote. Gladys?
Aye.
Megan?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Tim?
Aye.
Eric?
I'm just going to disclose, I have had the pleasure of making a little money at Slopeswell playing music, but I think it's de minimis and it's not impacting my discretion. So I'm going to vote. Someone can disqualify me if they want me to, but I don't think it's material and I vote aye.
Okay. And Jessica, you are
I'm abstaining.
Abstaining. Okay. All right. And chair votes aye. So we've passed the consent agenda. Regular business items, contract with Leland Consulting for the Rand Road development. Kevin.
Thank you, Mayor McBride and councilors. Can you hear me? Great. Next item on your agenda is a contract between the city and Leland Consulting Group. The cover sheet is on page 302 of the council packet, and the contract begins on page 305. Last October, with the adoption of Resolution 2019-14, the City Council took a step toward purchasing a 7-acre parcel on Rand Road to help provide opportunities for a more inclusive and diverse housing inventory. The purchase was completed in February, and in the spring, staff began working on a request for proposals to solicit consulting firms to provide a housing development advisory service. The RFP is found on page 319 of your packet. It was released in July, and we were really fortunate to receive responses from 8 consulting firms. Leland Consulting Group's response to the RFP is in your packet for reference. The 8 responses were reviewed by a committee consisting of city staff and members of the local development community. In late September, the 2 highest scoring consulting teams were interviewed. Leland Consulting Group, in partnership with HerbsWorks and DDV Consulting Services, was unanimously selected by the review committee. The development strategy that will be prepared by the consultants will include recommending the optimal type and scale of housing to be pursued on the parcel, whether ownership, rental, or a combination should be developed, what levels of income or sales price, rental rate restrictions could best be produced, and effective methods for achieving city goals related to housing and community development. The consulting team also will prepare a request for qualifications to be issued to the development and partner community for disposition and development of the site. And the contract explains the consultant's tasks, including community engagement, beginning on page 310 of the council packet. After completing the contract, Leland will be available to assist the city with other services, such as negotiating with a developer. Staff does recommend that the council authorize the city manager to execute the personal services contract with Leland Consulting Group, HerbsWorks, and DDB Consulting Services, and to make any non-material changes to the contract prior to execution. There's a draft motion on the cover sheet, and with that, I would open it up to any questions.
Great, thank you, Kevin. There's a lot of work that's gone into this prior to getting this far. So thank you so much for all your work and the working group's participation in screening all this and doing the interviews. Thanks. So questions? Gladys?
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Kevin, and all for your work on this. I just want to ask very specific questions about point number 10 and even point 12. Contractor shall not assign this contract or subcontract any portion of the work without written consent of the city. So I'm wondering, I don't see anything in here where we talk about working with local agencies such as Aging in the Gorge Alliance or even the Next Door when we're talking about the, you know, it was brought up on the call early about the end user. I do remember that there was a portion where that MIG came up for the heights, and that I remember specifically stating, I don't see anything about the Next Door or any other group, and that was added to it. And so I'm wondering if we can add that now.
Well, I think it's certainly possible to add specific groups. The way the contract is set up, it essentially places the responsibility on me and other staff members to put together a list of stakeholder groups to participate in interviews with the consulting team. And I certainly heard Claire Culbertson earlier this evening, as well as Bonnie New of the Aging in a Gorge Alliance a couple of weeks ago. She spoke to council and was thinking that they may be one of those stakeholders or groups of community members who would be interested in participating. So I don't think we necessarily need to change the contract to specify Aging in the Gorge Alliance or Next Door Incorporated, but we certainly could do that.
Can we at least specify that we will contract, or maybe the city would make recommendations on local groups that can work with them? I mean, not being very specific to a name, I guess.
Certainly.
And let me jump in for just a second. We would love your input on the council's input on who we should be reaching out to, absolutely. And there will be a public process associated with this. The city will be working directly with we don't know who yet, but we will work directly with someone to support translation and to support reaching out to our Latino population. That's not something we're actually relying on the consultant to do. That's something that we are going to take on, on behalf of our community.
Okay, great. Additional questions? Eric?
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Kevin, for your hard work on this, and everyone. I'm very supportive of this project and I'm pleased to see this moving forward. I was curious, Kevin, with respect to the role, if any, that you see of Mid-Columbia Housing in connection with this project. I realize that role might be a little different than what we're potentially hiring this group to do, but Leland, but is Mid-Columbia Housing going to be involved with this project like it was with the potential project on Morrison Park?
Well, I think that the organization certainly should be one of the stakeholders that works with a consultant early in the process. And as alternatives are evaluated for development of the site, the consulting team may recommend that Mr. Madsen's organization is participating in some manner. But you know, we didn't want to scope that specifically. We wanted to keep things open and allow that input to get to the consulting team and then hear their recommendations and let them help us put together that strategy.
Right, because these folks, the idea of this contract is to be a consultant to the city to help us in our decisioning, which might be different than, you know, the developer's perspective, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Kevin.
Welcome. Thank you.
Let's see who else held their hand up. Mark, I think you did. And then we'll go to Jessica.
Like everyone else says, you know, I'm really excited that this is finally coming out from under the covers, as it says. So council has had zero role or discussion of vision or anything since we approved buying the property, and I'm curious and a little anxious about where do you see council coming in and what role are we going to play, because it's not really explicit, the council discussion in here, and so what's the plan?
Rachel, if you want to jump in, please do. My expectation is that there will be multiple touch points for the council through the process. Early on, along with the stakeholders, an opportunity for the council to weigh in and help identify goals and objectives for the site. And as we move forward, working with neighbors and advocacy groups, other members of the community to identify options and preferences. Again, checking back in with council and explaining where we are as things move forward. Again, Rachel, do you have any specific comments?
Kevin, the only thing I would add is that there's a really important council touch point at the end of this first process, which is outlining the goals based on all the work that we do, outlining the goals for the developer solicitation. So at the end of this, we're going to do a request for proposals or a request for qualifications to the developer community. So we will have wanted to talk to council about what some of the trade-offs are with various strategies and really have council weigh in on what the priorities are so that we can put a request for qualifications out there that we think is viable and is financially feasible. And council has weighed in on what some of those trade-offs might be.
So is council the decider of the accepted vision before we go out to RFPs and stuff?
Absolutely.
Okay, I mean, that's a great answer. I didn't really see it, though, in there. So it's like, are we just...
Great. It's a great question. And absolutely. With all of the information, we want it to be an informed decision. With all of the information that we'll get from the financial analysis, the site analysis, and the community input.
Absolutely. I really look forward to the discussion and just couldn't tell where we fit in.
Jessica?
Thank you. Yeah, and that I know Megan had her hand up then. So I, through reading all of this, which it seems it's a wonderful proposal and I'm excited to get started. The end goal does not show what will be developed, but what is desired, right?
Desired, and we expect financially feasible.
Okay. I think that's going to be, and they kind of referenced it in their proposal, but I think it's going to be important to stress that throughout because I think it's going to be very confusing for the public. They're going to think that this is what we're going to build.
And I think that one of the points that we focused on quite a bit with the consulting team as we went through this was being clear about the outcome. And they probably don't tell us exactly what happens on the site, but they are able to come up with a strategy that reflects the interests of the community, the goals for this specific site, and again, in a financially feasible way of developing the property.
Thank you. And I just as another comment, I was going to say, I appreciate that they have experience working with some smaller communities. I saw that in the packet. I thought there was some similar communities to Hood River. And they also that the they had a statement that the result would be a demonstration project for how a variety of affordable housing types can be seamlessly integrated into the surrounding community fabric and improve the neighborhood. And I think that's really what we want this to be, to show the community what could be done and also, you know, answer what the community is telling us that they want to have happen here. So, so thank you for bringing this and I'm excited.
Tim and then Megan.
Yeah, same comment as everybody. Thanks, Kevin, for doing this. Looks really good. I did hear you mention earlier on that members of the development community sat on the selecting committee. Just to be completely transparent, can you just tell us who those development members were?
Of course. We had two members of the local development community, including Henry Fisher, who developed the 310 Oak building where Doppio is today downtown, as well as Maui Meyer, of Copper West Real Estate, former county commissioner.
Thank you.
Megan?
Sorry, can't unmute. I think overall this, I mean, God, these consultants seem so qualified and I'm excited to see this going forward. I guess I have kind of two questions or points of, great to have the conversation about stakeholders and definitely the Next Door and Agent in the Gorge and those folks are super critical in that. But I guess I'm wondering, like, especially compared to the Heights thing, this is significantly less fleshed out on like the larger community engagement, the surveys and other things, how we're going to reach out to populations that tend to struggle to be engaged in kind of the more traditional outreach that we do. So not just through stakeholders, but individual people and underserved populations. So how we're going to do that. And then I think also that like, if we're getting surveys and one of the specific things was like, oh, you get a percentage of people that like this result. Are we going to get the feedback that says, okay, 50% of respondents liked X, but those respondents were all tend to be higher income than our average population. Like, are we going to be able to know that our survey respondents kind of match our actual residents, or that it's skewed in some way, or like, you know, a survey without context, I guess, is not necessarily a full picture. And so is this consultant group going to provide that information?
Well, I think they're going to do the best they can with staff's assistance. COVID obviously has created some challenges for us. We can't necessarily get people together in a big meeting and discuss options. We're talking about relying really heavily on a web page, electronic communication. Obviously not everybody has access to the internet, and that's something we were raised with the consultants. And so we've got in the scope right now, in addition to those digital means of communication, also putting together some written boards and distributing, or I'm sorry, providing opportunities for the public to review the information that is being presented in a public location, such as City Hall or other locations that we find are safe. But if you or other counselors have ideas about who the stakeholders are, who we should be approaching early on in the process and trying to make sure we get as representative input from the broader community as best as possible, totally open to your suggestions and recommendations. I think we have a pretty good idea of how to go about it, but certainly can be refined.
Thank you, Kevin. I guess it's a twofold thing of like doing the best we can to get outreach and engagement from everyone is the one thing. And it does sound like you guys are, you know, we've learned from various other things and we have a direction and hopefully we can do that and improve it. But also, I guess the end result of like, hey, we got all these responses. Like, did we succeed in getting the full population to provide input or, you know, can we see from the demographic data that like, oh, look, all of this feedback is a little skewed in a certain direction. Because I don't want to make decisions for the whole community if a third of the community didn't actually have a say in it.
Sure.
I guess.
So I think if this is getting specifically at surveys, I don't think we're talking about a scientific survey, but again, do we have an opportunity to get feedback? Have we effectively received feedback from as many members of the community, as many organizations in the community, advocacy groups, et cetera, to help explain early on what they would like to see on the site. And then as development options are prepared by the consulting team, then refining that work based on additional input from the community about, again, we're looking for financially feasible development alternatives for the site, which will put some constraints on ultimately what we get to see there. One of those being right off the bat, we've got, we need to, based on the loan the city obtained from the state, achieve a minimum of 50 units on the site for housing at 120% of area median income or below for at least 30 years. And obviously we've got other members of the community interested in going much deeper. And we'll have to see how the pro formas come together to tell us again about not only the options that the community desires, but whether or not we can come up with a solution that is financially feasible and that we can attract a developer to the project to build it.
Okay. And then I think a little bit addressed with Mark's question, but I guess I'm still a little, it does still feel like City Council doesn't have as much input as it seems like we should on something this big. You know, if we're approving this before it goes to the RFQ or whatever acronym the end result is, but like, I know 310, it's meeting with city staff to discuss the city's vision for the property is like the kickoff, and that seems like something that should not be staff but should be council. Or like, is staff going to get input from council before that meeting, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think, Councillor, some of this we are going to have to work through together. You represent the public as the owner of this property. So you are the final decision maker about what happens. So absolutely, we would not be doing our job if we weren't incorporating your input along the way. I do think we need to get started so that we know what questions to ask Council, and that's part of what our consultant will be helping us do. But if there's ever a time where Council doesn't feel like you have information or you want some input into the process, we're happy to come to a Council meeting at any point.
Yeah, I guess I think it's always the like, and you know this about me, of the like, is it's like easier for my brain to see it before it suddenly is like, we want approval now, so that the like time frame of
that is not our plan, Councillor. That is not our plan. That's not how we work. And I would say just today, here we are. If there are goals, if there are, you know, if there's input that Council wants to give us right now, we're open to taking it. If there's clear direction other than what we already know we have to do and what we've heard from Council in previous meetings, you know, at your discretion, we're here to talk about it. Okay. We welcome any feedback or input.
So I have a little bit of feedback then. If we're going to go that there, I'll get you next, Gladys. You're on next. So we know the criteria that our grant funds have told us that we have to do, at least. And I think, first of all, we need to figure out what the physical constraints are of the property, because it won't matter what anybody wants. If, you know, we have to go around a wetland, we have to figure out, you know, there's underwater coming down the hill. It's too steep, whatever it is. So I think the physical constraints have to be number one, and then we have to see how much land we have left. Personally, I would like to get two things. Besides what we have required, I would like to have as much 80 to 60% area median income housing as we can possibly get on that lot. You know, if we can get some R1 in there, that's great. I'd like to have some, but I personally think that having 60 to 80% as much as possible is what I want to see on there. And I also want to see some park space, and I want to see that park space next to that density, because the people that are in the density need the park space. I mean, that was one of the things, those that article, I think it was in the New York Times, that Susan Crowley sent us about apartments, you know, being heat spots. Well, that, you know, we need to have those parks right next to those heat spots so that they can have some green space. So, you know, personally, those are the two things that I'd like to see. And I don't know if that's financially feasible. That may not be financially feasible at all, but that's where I'd like to start personally. Go ahead, Gladys.
Like you were right here looking at the questions I had next. A lot of the same two lines, and also that with the addition that the parks really be inclusive of multi-generation, you know, using the parks. I want to talk about something that I heard Kevin say, that if there was some sort of survey, that it would be a web-based. And so I have a concern with that because I see a barrier. So I guess to offer a solution, that it's not all necessarily on you, Kevin, or city staff to figure it out. If there was a phone option that folks had to conduct this survey, and that again, it not be city staff, that it be agencies like the Nextdoor or AGA, who might already have folks that they're communicating with, where they could figure out a more equitable way, as web-based, not everyone has hotspots or Wi-Fi at home, in order to be able to answer, nor would they feel comfortable, to be quite honest, to go and click through a survey that's web-based. So I wanted to bring up those additions since we're talking about, you know, what we'd like to see.
Excellent. Thank you.
Tim?
Well, I guess for throwing out our wish list, I think one of the things that I would like to see is that in, as part of the affordability equation, that we actually look at renewable energy and solar development on the project, and that that be incorporated into the discussion somehow.
Thank you, Councillor.
Mark?
So it is, I'm a little bit confused. I'm happy to talk about what my vision is too, but is this really, are we gonna, is that gonna be facilitated by the consultant, basically the starting point, or are we, is this what we're doing right now?
Councillor, what we are hoping to do is get some baseline information with the consultant, and then we would be able to come back to council to have a robust discussion. But as I said, we are wide open. If there are, you know, if there are some must-haves, then it would be great for us to know.
But, you know, I think that, you know, we've gone all this far, this distance in setting up this contract with these people that are super qualified. And I just, you know, I think what you're seeing is that we're hungry to provide the vision and inputs that we've just been sitting on for waiting for some go point. And we haven't got a go point. So if it's early in the meetings with these people, then that's wonderful. And we'll, and you know, and I'll be prepared to, you know, provide a neat vision. But if that doesn't, I can't tell if that exists or not. So if it doesn't exist, I should talk now, right? That's the question.
I think we're going to get a lot more time to input, Mark. I mean, I just wanted to give my two cents and try and make it short, but I'm sure we're going to get lots more time to give more input.
All right. So I have lots of input, but I will wait.
Okay. Anyone else? Any additional comments? We've got a motion on page 303, if anybody's ready.
I move to authorize the city manager to execute a personal services contract with Leland Consulting Group to prepare a strategy and development solicitation for development of the site at 780 Rand Road to include changes to the contract recommended by the city attorney and to make any non-material changes to the contract prior to execution.
I have a motion by Gladys.
A second.
And Jessica has made a second. Additional discussion on the contract? Roll call vote, Jessica?
Aye.
Jim?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
Gladys?
Aye.
Megan?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
And chair votes aye. All right, go forth. Thank you for all that work, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Thank you, councilors.
Okay. Let's see here. All right, next regular business item is the fee resolution 2020-16 in lieu parking fee. So Dustin's gonna give us some information on that, but we actually have three people, and hopefully they've been hanging in with us. At least some of them I can see on here have, that wanted to speak on this. So we're going to do the 3 minutes business from the audience regarding in lieu right now. So the first person that signed up, Jonathan, is Brian Tuohy, and then we will have Kirk, Zach, and Linda Maddox. So go ahead, Brian.
Thank you, Mayor. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Brian.
Okay. 2 weeks ago, this on the consent agenda as was used to make the case 2 weeks ago for this is sufficient to make a change in other places. You believe that in-lieu parking fees should be changed in the Heights as well as downtown to treat the same zones in different neighborhoods the same because they're in the same zone classification. So if that's the argument, then the parking study should not have been, should not have treated downtown as so distinctly unique an area, but it did. The study was so acutely focused on downtown that it suggested to all interested parties that downtown is the only place where policy would possibly be study affected. The realities of parking need in each of these zones, including West Cascade that wasn't mentioned before, and the challenges to new development are definitely distinct from each other. For example, would you let a large grocery store simply pay rather than provide parking? That would be in a commercial zone, and that is essentially the argument that you're making by applying this to all zones, including the Heights. So, you know, and the Heights is what is of immediate importance, you know, as it has different characteristics than downtown. It provides easier opportunities to provide parking to support new development. Even the environmental impact statement in the cover sheet tonight even specifies, in quotes, adaptive reuse of existing structures, acknowledging that distinction. And, you know, that makes sense. New development shouldn't be exempted from providing adequate parking, as it is almost always possible to include it. So another word about parking need downtown, that, you know, more parking capacity is needed, as was explained in the recent parking study. You know, by allowing development in historic buildings, again, a good idea, but you've increased the number of new spots that you're going to need in the future. And I find it, you know, interesting that none of you appear to be curious that the same people that argued for STR regulations have proposed market rate development, some of them very high end, in zones that are now exempt from STR regulation. So, you know, it's apparent that some of you misunderstand those STR regulations and how in-lieu reductions will place further demand on parking, requiring, you know, even more added capacity. So all of these residential homes and commercial zones absolutely can be used as STRs. And I've explained this previously with data showing the rate at which this is happening. So, you know, please, you know, stop, you know, asserting that these homes are exempt, because it's just not true. If you read the 2015 housing needs analysis, you'll see an action that mentions considering parking exemptions in limited circumstances for addition of affordable housing. So this would incentivize needed housing types for low-income or aging citizens, for example. Providing exemptions for new market rate developments doesn't make any sense and may reduce the options to induce affordable housing in that way in the future. So, you know, for example, for Councilor Rivera, with, you know, regard to affordable housing, according to the 2015 housing needs analysis, the high density housing that, you know, that you mentioned being interested in earlier is supposed to be happening in commercial zones. And, you know, I'd be happy to discuss that with you privately if you like some other time. So to conclude, making these in-lieu changes will exacerbate our unresolved parking problem. And, you know, all this while there are new urban renewal discussions and transportation system plan projects going on in the Heights that'll shed some light on some of these issues. You know, before you consider something in the Heights, you should consult with the business owners and the residents there and see what they think. So as stated in my written comments that should be in the packet, also the suggested motion listed as alternative two on the cover sheet reads differently than the suggested motion described as alternative two on page 385 of the packet, which is what the way this process goes, you would read as a suggested resolution. So I think that's unusually deceptive. So if you do choose to do this, the suggested resolution, you know, please use the alternative language above, not down at the bottom. So the correct path, if you insist on approving tonight's resolution, would be to change only downtown and make no changes to the Heights or waterfront districts until they can be thoughtfully and independently considered. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Brian. Kirk, Zach?
Hi, Mayor McBride and the councilors. You guys can hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
That's great. Thank you very much. Thanks, Brian. I don't have all of the facts and figures that Brian perhaps has, as I've jumped into this here just recently, as you guys are probably aware. But my name is Kirk Zach, and I'm concerned that we're applying an in-lieu parking fee that was designated for downtown to the entire town in a broad stroke. I don't know what studies were done or what studies we could look at, but I want to make sure that it's open up to all city residents, or as Brian said, if there's businesses, so they can see how it affects them as well. I'm also concerned that you know, we have a law that requires parking, yet we have created a loophole that gets around the parking issue. Perhaps a development can be have a certain amount of size or space, and yet they can just buy their way out of doing it. I think Brian's example with the grocery store was a good one. In any case, so I just want to have my voice heard that I am concerned about this. I'd like to hear more about it. And again, I'll agree with Brian. He took the words out of my mouth that if this is applied, it should be applied simply to where it was originally started, which is to downtown, not into the port area or other areas of town where we haven't had time to do all the proper studies. Thank you all for listening to me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And Linda? Maddox?
Madam Mayor, I believe Ms. Maddox was signed up for the rezone. And it's just a mistype.
Oh, okay. Okay, all right. I thought maybe she was going to comment on both or something. Okay. So that's our public comment. So staff report. I think, Dustin, are you going to take this one?
Thank you, Mayor. Moving to page 382 of your packet includes a cover sheet regarding the resolution that you have here. It's council's purview and by Hood River Municipal Code to set the in-lieu parking fees for, and it actually mentions every year. In 2006, when we did our first downtown parking study, the city's takeaway and implementation was to institute an in-lieu fee, which it didn't have before that time. And at that time, council adopted the in-lieu fee of parking for not only downtown, but the waterfront and the Heights all at one time upon the analysis of downtown. And at that time, it used a singular method for all zones. So there was no unique analysis for setting the rate. And throughout time, the same resolution has been used for each of these zones. So when we did our resolution, we looked at not specifically changing the other zones upon recommendation. We just followed suit with the resolution to follow the static and consistent regulations. So upon hearing concern from council at last reading of the resolution, we provided alternatives within this resolution that you were able to choose from if you saw fit. Those include changing just the fee in lieu for downtown, as described in the Rick Williams study. That would change both for residential and commercial. There's another alternative that would include changing for downtown and leaving the Heights and the waterfront amounts alone, not changing the rates. And then there's a third resolution, or excuse me, alternative that includes changing no rates. So that would be this is all council's purview regarding how it wants to treat the rates. The first resolution as amended is definitely a more simplified approach, and it follows kind of the static amounts that you currently use now. You don't differentiate the waterfront from the Heights from downtown by way of rates. You certainly could do that. That's your purely your discretion on that. So. We have a resolution, I think, that addresses the change suggested by Rick Williams in the narrowest form, a change that an alternative that would be the status quo of where you're at now, and a change to just change downtown and leave the other twos. But again, this is your fee resolution. This is purely your discretion on how to execute. So we're here for questions on that.
Jessica?
Thank you, Mayor. I am going to recuse myself from this conversation with the Slopeswell, my husband and partner's business in the Heights, and there might be a fee in lieu question coming up for them. So I'm going to stay out of this conversation.
Thank you for that disclosure, Jessica. Anyone want to go first? Mark?
I just can't go second, I guess. That's okay. Dustin, have there ever been in lieu applications or cases where in lieu came up in the Heights?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we've used in lieu Heights for commercial uses. So currently the current fee that's administered across the city or across the three districts has been used for commercial in the Heights.
So veering from question to opinion is, you know, I think that we had good discussions on the parking committee about downtown, and I think that we have a good solution for downtown. I'm fully supportive of what we've been doing. I do think that more of a robust of what does this mean, especially for housing in lieu in the Heights, I don't feel like we've had enough of a discussion of it yet. So I'm in favor of a two-line thing in the fee structure, you know, one for downtown and the other for the Heights. And I guess the which one the waterfront follows, since there's no housing in the waterfront, maybe it just follows the downtown one. But two lines until we can have, you know, sort of a discussion, you know, maybe it's driven by the urban renewal thing in the Heights where that can come up again, but I'm in favor of a two-line fee structure.
Who else had their hand up? Tim?
To be clear, Dustin, alternative two is changing the central business district and then leaving the other two districts as they are right now.
Correct. That would be just the change, the way that I crafted, summarized it, is change of only the central business district, fee and lieu rates.
And that's alternative two on page 385.
And 383, yeah. They should line up. They may not be the exact verbiage, but alternative twos match.
Okay. Thank you.
Others? Megan?
I guess, I mean, I think I'm going to repeat Tim's question, but so there's not a discrepancy between the alternative twos per Bryant's comment.
One is just the resolution is very articulate. It goes into speaking to the total amounts, whereas on 383, it's basically a motion to accept alternative two.
Okay, thank you. I guess I at least want to do some clarity things based on the comments of, you know, fee and lieu in general isn't all around town. It's specifically just these three commercial districts that we've outlined. So like West Cascade doesn't have fee and lieu. Residential districts don't have fee and lieu, correct?
The fee and lieu is eligible to three discrete areas, the waterfront, the central business district, and the Heights business district.
Okay. And under these current fee and lieu scenarios, a grocery store could be built without any parking and actually would pay half of what the proposed fee and lieu would be given our current fee and lieu cost as a commercial use.
As a commercial piece, the price would go up.
With the new fee and lieu. Like if under the current scenario, a grocery store in the Heights would pay $1,200 per space and not have to build any parking.
Correct. They would be, at the current scenario, they would be required to provide 1.2 spaces for every 1,000 square feet. And then at a rate of $1,259 per space, they would be required to pay that. Under the current, they would be required, or in this proposal, they'd be required to provide 1.5 spaces per 1,000 square feet and pay $3,000 per space. So that rate goes up. Net rate is based upon the downtown analysis. that we just did this year.
Right. And I know we talked about this last time, but this doesn't outright ban short-term rentals, but a short-term rental would need to find parking in some other form and can't use the fee in lieu to achieve its parking standard for licensing.
Correct. So that's not by this resolution, but right. In your ordinance change, it specifically states that this that a short-term rental still needs to provide its mandatory parking, and that a fee in lieu could not be used to satisfy a short-term rental parking regulation. So you cannot buy yourself out. Nor did the exemption for upper story conversions of residential provide that opportunity.
Okay, thank you. Kate, were we just doing questions now, or should I talk about my feelings?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
No, I would say, you know, ask questions.
Okay. Then, yeah, I guess I, you know, based on the last meeting, I probably can see where this is going, but given that this proposal, even just for downtown, is purely a temporary thing for like the estimated 2 years for us to go through the process of actually figuring out our long-term plan for fee in lieu. And given the failures of our fee in lieu right now and the incredibly insane discrepancies between residential and commercial, I'm comfortable with changing it for all districts, but I also am guessing the rest of council won't go there, and I'm comfortable with just doing downtown if that's where we go. So.
Eric or Gladys? Eric?
Sure, I'll go, Mayor. Thank you very much. I think this is an improvement from where we were in the last meeting. I still do have some concerns, and I guess I should start off by saying, based on what I'm hearing tonight, it sounds like I may have been incorrect in some of the things I was positioning around relative to the short-term rentals. I'm not sure, but if I needed to be corrected there, I'll stand corrected. But I think I still have some lingering concerns about this. I agree with Councillor Saunders that the numbers are just way out of whack, and we should be bringing the commercial up. That's not appropriate to have such a low amount, because I think the actual cost to construct an actual parking space in downtown Hood River, that number came up in, I think, a URAC meeting at some point, and don't hold me to this, but it was something on the order of 35, 40, 45,000. So all the numbers we're talking about are for this measure are significantly below the actual costs. And in fact, the parking study analysis specifically says that, quote, the fee in lieu itself was inadequate to the actual cost of delivering new structured parking. And that's, I think, both at the very low commercial, but even the seemingly high residential is below the actual cost. I guess the reason I remain concerned about this, I would be happy to raise the rate for commercial downtown. I support limiting this to downtown for now. If it were just up to me, and I know it isn't, but if it were just up to me, I would just limit this to the historical adjustment that we're making through the separate measure, and I wouldn't pass this. And I guess the fee in lieu issue has gotten a lot of criticism, and rightly so. But it seems if you read carefully Rick Williams' report, he's really encouraging this not as a way to solve the parking problem, but as a way to gain this different goal of more housing downtown, which frankly wasn't part of his mission. So I think from a parking, if the goal is just about parking, frankly, part of this existing expensive fee in lieu for residential is positive. And it's the unbroken part is that it's a stop loss measure against condo development downtown, whether STR or otherwise, that is going to put more parking pressure on our downtown business owners, sort of in favor of what will ultimately be very expensive, high-end, out-of-towners buying condos in Hood River. And I'm just feeling like, and there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg problem here, but I feel like I want to solve the parking problem before making it worse downtown. So I would probably choose option 3, or even, I guess, option 4, which is to just forget this altogether, pass the bill, or the ordinance as concerns exempting historic buildings, because those to me are fundamentally different. It's sort of like the Measure 37 concept. These buildings have been here forever and these ordinances grew up around them, and they're going to wilt if they don't get developed, and we need to preserve that. To me, I would exempt altogether the historic buildings. I think we're doing that. But I am concerned this makes parking worse in the name of making it better, when Rick Williams was talking about housing, not parking, when he's making these recommendations, which was outside of the purview. So I guess, where does that leave me? Leaves me concerned about lowering fee in lieu downtown Hood River for residential to 3,000. I would support making those more level playing field, but it just feels too low when the actual cost is 35 plus thousand per space. So that might put me in a different position than my colleagues. I think I'm just a no all around on this. The other thing I'll say is I actually couldn't read page in my printout, page 384 and 385, where there's something about the kerneling of the letters. I couldn't even read it on my particular copy, but I'm probably, I'm very open to revisiting the imbalance in the fee in lieu. I agree with Councillor Saunders that it is just off. We should be fixing these things, but making it a flat three downtown, to me, makes it worse, not better.
So I just wanted to, and Mark, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but when the parking committee was meeting, I felt like we had a consensus of the group, you and I included, and the other business owners, because it was business owners and building owners, who both felt like that having some residential downtown would help them, because then they would have more year-round customers. It would be more lively in the winter, kind of thing. And that was, you know, that was the reason that Rick Williams had put some information in that report about trying to help reinvigorate downtown and have more housing downtown. Did I get that right, Mark? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's a parking issue, in the parking requirements was a roadblock to other things we wanted to do. So that's why it became, was part of the thing. And also, if we're looking at funding of long-term parking solutions, in lieu is a tool that some cities use. And the way that Hood River has implemented in lieu, it was not working. So it was both a hindrance on housing, and it was a hindrance on raising money for new parking. So in lieu being just flat broken in Hood River was one of the things that came up. And certainly we talked about just scrapping it all together. It's just not even a thing. Don't even, you know, just make it go away. Rick Williams had seen it work well in some cities, and so his proposal is that we find a way to make it work.
And I think that, you know, the reason that we wanted to try and make it work, even doing this interim thing right now, was because we felt like the businesses wanted to be able to have some residential downtown. And leaving it like it is a moratorium on that, in essence. And so that was the reasoning. And, you know, if you feel like I don't want more housing downtown for whatever reason, then a moratorium is a good thing. So that, you know, that's kind of, you know, we were like, well, we don't think that's a good thing. So that's why we're talking about it, in essence. Who has not spoken yet? Gladys, did you go ahead?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment that I'd be willing to support for it to read to downtown only. Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Anything else? I mean, we could try a motion of some sort and see where we get with it. How many people want to do something?
I forgot I also wanted to bring up that my packet reads the same. So page 385 is pretty challenging to read. Like, it's not all the letters are included as well.
Can you see that in your packet, Dustin? That's what it looks like?
No, the packet I have, the electronic PDF packet, is perfectly legible. It appears that somewhere along the line that in printing, that is looks like a symptom of justification. Like if you justify a page and you have too many, it wants to block it out. But the packet I have is perfectly legible and well formatted by Jen Gray.
Okay, and the gist of what it, with the correct justification is, let me just reiterate these things. There's one motion that changes it to $3,000 for residential and commercial in all three business districts. There's also an option to change it to $3,000 for residential and commercial only in the central business district and leave any other districts that we have at the current rates that we have now. And then there's another motion to basically status quo, change nothing. Correct?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Mayor, we put alternative three just so you had all three of them in there, but you don't need to actually pass a resolution, and you have alternative three right now.
Okay, so we don't have to do
this three. Helps to see them side by side.
Okay, you'd put three on there, so that's why I was reading it. So does anyone have a motion?
So Kate, I'll make a motion towards alternative two. So I make a motion to approve resolution 2020-18, amending resolution 2017-18 to change the in-lieu parking fee, where this is a fee thing, to $3,000 per residential and commercial space for only the central business district and maintain the current methodology in the other two business districts.
I'll second that.
We have a motion by Mark and a second by Megan. Additional discussion? Tim?
So I have a question. So essentially we are changing the central business district to 3,000. So that's a change. So the other ones are remain the same. And I've heard it said multiple times that really what we need to do is we need to have a discussion to figure out what happens in the other districts. And I'm just questioning, when is that discussion, and what does that discussion look like, and how is it facilitated?
I'm going to hazard a guess that's like the downtown parking study, but for the Heights, so down the road a ways.
So this really just makes two fee lines in the fee structure instead of one, and when we change the Heights and Waterfront fee is up to us, I guess, right?
Correct. Your opportunity is every year, or at any time, you can change the rate. So this is not an ordinance that requires a public hearing or to go through the planning commission process. It's council's purview to set the rate technically every year, but at any opportunity, you could change the rate.
So can I ask a follow-up question? My follow-up question is there a problem that's been identified with the in-lieu fee structures for the other two districts that we would need to have a discussion?
I think when you read the Rick Williams memo, although it doesn't articulate individual districts, since we have the same philosophy and the same methodology, you could say the dysfunction is probably general. It's basically the market is rejected this because they get nothing in return. So that's a stretch. I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that. It doesn't speak to each of those districts individually, but you've never had that discussion on those districts individually. So I have no historic record of that. But generally it speaks to how we administer fee in lieu and why it doesn't work. Why hasn't it worked? And I think you could take from that, it is not unique to downtown.
So is it also true then that for the leaving the other two districts the same, that in some of the districts, they would actually be paying less, is that correct, than the $3,000?
For commercial, yeah.
Yeah, your commercial rates in both waterfront as well as the Heights would pay less.
And the residential would be way higher.
So really, we're just making it, you know, we're providing an opportunity for the other districts to actually pay less.
Pay what they're paying now. Yeah.
Is that really, you know, what we're shooting for here?
My motion was to say that they're two different discussions and they should have two different fee lines. I'm not arguing that the fee line remaining for the Heights is the most the most well thought out fee structure. But until there's two lines in the fee structure, we can't decide what should the Heights be relative to downtown.
But then again, I'm hearing that there's really no timeline for actually having those discussions.
You're correct, Tim. We don't have anything on our schedule right now. We did the parking study and this came out of the parking study and we're changing part of it, but now, you know, it's kind of like, well, we need to do another study on the Heights if that's what we feel like we need to do to figure it out better. Personally, I think I'm not going to vote for it, but because I think it should be 3,000 everywhere. I just think it needs to be needs to be fair for everyone, the same for everyone all over the city. I always felt that the historic district stuff was down here in downtown and the fee in lieu was completely different and it was citywide. That's how I always understood it to be. And I just think that, you know, it'd be great to have some more residences on second stories up in the Heights too. And maybe they could use the lower fee to get some more residential up there in some of those areas. But, you know, that's my vote.
Right. And I guess what I'm seeing here is that we're actually making it for the commercial end of it, having it cost less. So, you know, given the argument that, you know, the grocery store could buy their way out of it, I mean, given we're actually making it easier for them to do that by making it less.
What it's been for the last 10 years or 7 years or something like that. So we're increasing downtown's commercial, reducing downtown's housing, and not changing them in the other two districts until we have the chance to talk about what they should be in the other two districts. That's the motion.
So I think we have an explanation. We are pretty clear on what the motion is. More discussion, Eric?
Just very briefly, Mayor, because I know well enough when I've lost an argument, so I'm just going to shut up here in a second. But I'm actually agreeing with you, Mayor. If there is a way to, I think it might be that it's just the unscientific, or at least my perception, the unscientific way of $3,000 when that is a fraction of the actual cost of parking. That makes me uncomfortable. If it was $15.15 across the city and we involved the other business districts to decide that, that might be different, but three is just so low. And to me, it's not, I'm not trying to support a moratorium on downtown housing. I think more housing downtown would be great. It's just that at $3,000, when we have a parking crisis downtown, what we're really doing is asking our local businesses to basically subsidize developers to put condos in Hood River downtown. And it's just too low for me there. So it may be just a function of the numbers. So I'm a no on this, but ironically, I kind of agree with the mayor. So I'm a no on this particular motion.
Okay, I think we have a motion. We have a second. Everyone knows what it is. So I think we need to call the vote here. So I'm going to go with Mark.
Yes.
Eric.
No.
Gladys.
Yes.
Tim.
No.
Megan.
Yes.
And I am a no. So we have three no's and three yeses. The motion didn't pass.
So, I mean, we did this last meeting where we tried the other motion and that also failed. So, like, what's the game plan to address this? Because the current situation is stupid, and I feel like everyone is agreeing on that, maybe minus Eric. Or he is agreeing, but for a different reason. But we can't figure out which of these two options. Like, how do we move forward?
So I want downtown to be fixed and at 3,000. So I will even vote for a single level if that's what it takes to do that.
I mean, I've already said I'm down with alternative one. So would we get four there?
I think so, but I can't make a motion. Tim?
I make a motion to approve resolution 2020-18, amending resolution 2017-18 to change the in-lieu parking fee to $3,000 for residential and commercial parking space in all three business districts.
I will second again.
Motion from Tim. Change the in-lieu parking fee to $3,000 in residential commercial districts in all three business districts. And a second from Megan. I'm just going to call the vote. I think we've had plenty of discussion. Tim?
Yes.
Megan?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Eric?
No.
Gladys?
Yes.
Chair votes aye. All right. Thank you everyone for that. Hard decision, lots of discussion. We'll see if it does, if we get any movement whatsoever with anything happening and anyone using this. I don't think people are gonna be running to our door tomorrow for it, but we'll see what happens. Planning Commission appointment process, Dustin.
Oh, jeez. We're back to page 396 of your agenda. This is really hopefully a representation of what council had discussed in 2019 for its pilot program, as well as the changes that that we heard from you in November, and an opportunity to review and interview with a subcommittee, but yet prior to having a motion and a selection on the agenda that council would review the roster as well as the recommendations, and then upon review of the entire council choose to schedule a candidate or candidates for interview before the entire body. So before there was an agenda item. And I think that was the important point of clarification that needed to be made. And hopefully I illustrated that in your packet, which is shown on 397. So if this again is totally at your discretion, this is your selection process. We just wanna make sure that we administer it in the way that council is happy and satisfied. So,
and Mayor, if I might, there is no motion needed on this. If council, we just heard last time that council wanted to be refreshed on the process. So because it was a pilot process last time. So that's why we brought this back.
Okay, great. Megan?
Because I did look at the past minutes when we talked about this, and I did just want to mention on 393, the reappointments that we, at our discretion, could reappoint without advertising. In the minutes from way back when, we said to actually remove that, and we'd always advertise. So if we could update for the future.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I've got some language. I had that change on here, too, and I've got some language that would... It would say council may choose to reappoint serving members but will openly recruit and interview new candidates and incumbent members for positions and vacancies. So we have to open it up and interview everyone. Anything else? Anyone? Everyone's good with where we are on this?
No, I just feel like I don't see anything about being very intentional about the folks that we are advertising to, or that we're working with our community partners to help us advertise these opportunities. I was not present when this was brought back over a year ago. So was there a conversation about that as well?
I think we'd advertised in the usual ways that we do, in the newspaper. We put it in there that, you know, we have an opening, and we put it on our website, and we might have it on Facebook, but those are the usual ways that and we would have a meeting and Dustin would say, well, we've got some openings coming up, that kind of thing, so people would hear it in our meeting. But I don't think we had additional advertising. Is that true?
Mayor, if I could, this is one of the reasons why the council put in place the stipend to serve on boards. This was actually, it was Planning Commission driven. And I think Dustin actually addresses it. Councilor, you are absolutely correct, Councilor Rivera. This, as Dustin says, needs to be a really intensive process. The Planning Commission is an incredibly important body, advising the City Council and making some important decisions. So we are absolutely open to recommendations and to assistance. Sometimes I think the best way is for councilors to ask people that they know are interested in city government. Planning Commission is a great way to get started, and they really do a service. So absolutely, it's important that we're reaching out to the entire community, and it is a very big commitment that we're asking these folks to make.
I bring that up because I had that conversation with Paul Blackburn a couple of years ago, and so I was the one that was saying, I'm a single mom, and if I have to pay for a babysitter, no way am I going to have to join you guys or want to join you guys. That's not going to be a value or worth my time if I have to go even more broke. So I want to make sure that we're being very intentional moving forward.
So that when we were researching, you know, for this pilot project, kind of the best practices we were learning from other communities about recruitment is really the personal ask and the personal touch. And so I do think it's incumbent on all of us as counselors to really reach out and try to recruit folks, because it is a huge ask. And so it's going to take someone kind of really getting that support to probably take the leap to say, yeah, I want to commit to two nights a month and a lot of paperwork, and just talk through that.
That's how I was recruited when I got on Planning Commission. It was a personal ask by somebody who was on council. You know, I think that's common. A lot of times that happens. All right. Are we in general okay? Is there someone else that had their hand up? Tim?
Yeah, I just want to clarify that, you know, when we're getting to the voting process, that will be provided with a full slate of candidates. I think that was a sticking point last time.
Yeah, and that's the specific clarification that we had before. You would not be provided just the recommendation, but the full roster for you. The body at large would be provided the full roster. Right. And then based on this, some clarification regarding reappointments still mandates an advertisement. So,
thank you.
Okay, thank you. Oh, Eric, did you have something or?
Just briefly, I wanted to echo Tim's comment because that was the one that was on my mind as well. So thank you for that clarification, Dustin. And I'll just say that in the chart we got, the gray text call out, the concept that is in there seems like a good addition. I didn't remember that before. Basically, it seems like council have an opportunity to kind of ahead of the meeting, give some signals or maybe the prior meeting about if they want to have different people actually present. So I like that as well. It seems to me that we're heading in the right direction.
Great. Thank you all for your comments. And we have this process open right now. So you have an open advertisement. We also have a constant advertisement on the website now. Once we redid our website, we always are asking for these volunteers. Again, it is a heavy lift. And so we're always looking, and we're always looking for people to join in. So this is your opportunity right now for that recruitment and personal touch that we talk about. So we're actively recruiting, and we'll be back with updates on how the process is headed.
And Dustin, is it two positions are up?
Yes. Yeah, you have one guaranteed vacancy and one a reappointment, which we have advertised for both.
Thank you.
Great. Eric?
And just one other brief point, kind of reflecting on some of the things we do at my place of employment. This idea of advertising is really important for diversity, because there have been studies that have been shown in other contexts that when you have kind of one board self-selecting its replacements or its subcommittees, it can function to squash diversity rather than broaden diversity. So having the broader brush of advertising in addition to our, you know, personal touches is, I think, helpful on the diversity front too.
All right. City Recorder, Jennifer, we have reading of ordinance 2056.
Your Honor, I'd like to entertain a motion for the second and final reading of ordinance 2056 by title only.
I will move we read ordinance 2056, historic buildings, for the second time by title only.
We have a motion.
Second.
And we have a second by Mark. The motion's by Megan.
Okay. Councillor Haney?
Aye.
Councillor Saunders?
Yes.
Councillor Cunahan?
Aye.
Councillor Mehta?
Aye.
Councillor Rivera?
Aye.
Councillor Zandmiller?
Yes.
Your Honor?
Yes.
Ordinance 2056, an ordinance amending Hood River Municipal Code, Title 17, Chapter 3, Land Use Zones, and Chapter 24, in lieu parking fee.
Thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate it. All right. Jessica or Megan, do you have any report from Visitors Advisory Committee?
Just super brief, and I had to skip out on part of the meeting to go to a board meeting, but basically, they've been redoing their budget to readjust to obviously significantly lower revenues for both Chamber and the Visit Hood River groups that are now being combined into one. I think they've done a really good, I mean, it obviously is drastic in change of lack of location now and change in the number of FTEs and change in everything they were planning to do that is obviously not going to happen or in the same way. But I think the budget they've come up with and the game plan they have going forward for the foreseeable future looks really good, is sustainable, is still providing important supports to our local business community and tourist industry. So I don't have, you know, not a lot of specifics. They're obviously still just trying to move forward in a difficult situation, but I think they've been doing a really good job.
Great, thank you for that report. Mayor Call, just a couple things. And the one thing was, there was a letter in your packet, and it's a request for payment in lieu. So payment in lieu, I don't know if everyone read this, but the payment in lieu of taxes are areas of the country that get payments from the federal government because they have federal land, like U.S. Forest Service land, that isn't taxed. So those counties don't get as much money as they normally would from those revenues and from taxes. And so the federal government has been paying payment in lieu to Hood River County for a long time. And some years it's good and some years it's non-existent, basically. But the gateway communities, this what this Mountain Pact is about, is there's communities that are close to federally accessed land, like the ski areas, and land that people hike on. And it uses up county resources trying to do search and rescue, for one thing, rescuing hikers and skiers and all those different kinds of things. And this is just a group that has gotten together, the Mountain Pact group, for these gateway communities such as ours. It's just asking for an additional fund to be set aside to be sent to those counties that, you know, who knows if it's going to go anywhere at all, if there's any money left after COVID-19. But I felt it was important that we ask for additional funding because I know that the county does help our community with search and rescue and things like that. So I just wanted everyone to know that I'd read this and I'm like, oh my God, you know, if we could get a little more funding for our county to help with those kind of things, it would be great. And so I went ahead and signed it, but I wanted you guys to know that I signed this, you know, asking that we be given a little bit extra money if they can get this passed on the federal level. So that's what it's about. Also, the only other thing I have is the shelter services, Hood River Shelter Services have picked a spot, and you may have heard about it from others, I'm not sure, but it's out at the Valley Christian Church. And their board had gone around and done some notifications after they were given the go-ahead to do it there by the church and the church board and the church congregation, and they all knew it was going to happen and were supporting it. And then the county gave notice that it was happening, and the neighbors have had some concerns. And so I've gotten a few phone calls about it myself, even though it's not in the city. And, you know, I'm working on the homeless committee. Rachel's also on that. And so Sarah Kellums, who's in charge of that nonprofit, asked me to be on a phone call, and I don't know what questions I can answer tomorrow night, but I'm going to be on a phone call that she's putting together so neighbors can ask questions. The sheriff's department will be on the phone call. Her board will be on the phone call, and Karen Joplin, who's in that district from the county, will be on the phone call. So I just wanted to let you know that I'm doing that just as a support for the shelter services. And that's all I have for this meeting. Megan?
I don't have anything beyond what I've already talked about, so thank you.
Tim, I know we've got this age-friendly community on here, and so maybe we could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. We were approached by actually Claire Culbertson, who is representing the Aging in the Gorge Alliance, and they requested that we draft a letter in support of their efforts to have Hood River become an age-friendly community. And the what that means is actually described in this letter that you see here. And so, you know, in as much as the Aging in the Gorge Alliance represents seniors in our community as doing that work, I am personally supportive of supporting their efforts. And I think that this letter is a small ask. Now, Mayor, you had mentioned that this is committing us to specific things. So is there anything that causes you concern about this, or Rachel?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I think that there was like a subcommittee that they might want us to form. You know, it says develop and plan of action that mm-hmm. responds to the needs identified by older adults and other residents that complements other city plans. So, you know, I'm not sure, measure the activities and review the outcomes. So I'm not really sure what that is committing us to, I guess. You know, I can see certain things, you know, things that we were trying to do already, and that, for instance, lowering the curbs and making them ADA compliant. You know, that's great for a 2-year-old and an 80-year-old. That's fantastic. And somebody that's in a wheelchair. So, I mean, that goes along with a whole bunch of different kinds of groups of people that have difficulties. And I think we're trying to do that as we can. But I'm not sure, you know, there's housing, which, you know, sometimes elderly don't have as much income, and they need to have different kinds of housing that are less expensive. We're trying to work on that. But I'm not sure how much time we have to put towards, you know, and maybe Aging in the Gorge can just give us a list and say, gosh, these are things that the city might be able to do or might help, or could you just add this as a line in some other document you have? But I'm just not sure how much time we have right now to spend a lot of time trying to, you know, do another committee for this specifically. So that's my worry. Megan, did you comment on it?
I guess on the time thing, because I just don't have a good scale of this, are there examples of like what other age-friendly communities are doing? Like what do you have to do to meet these bullet points?
And I don't know what that is. I don't know those specific things.
Yeah, I don't know specifically either, Megan, but I do know that the Aging in the Gorge Alliance is very committed to this cause, and I'm sure that they would be willing to step up and really pretty much lead this effort. So, you know, I think, you know, this is really their attempt, and I think my attempt as well, to kind of like bring this issue forward, because it is one that, you know, we have a variety of different things going on with respect to what we focus on, but none of those really deal with our seniors in our community. And so this seems like a pretty small ask for such an important part of our community.
As someone who leaves their blinkers on all the time, I don't see this as being a big ask right now. I mean, it's asking for a discussion about it, so it's not even fully defined yet. And if it's a committee that brings us, you know, quarterly updates to say, hey, you know, we're missing the boat on these things, then that's positive feedback from the community that we sort of talked about wanting more of anyway. So unless there's some hidden thing in here that's going to impact staff, then I'm supportive of having an official committee to listen to.
I was just concerned if we, the city, had to form the committee and staff it ourselves. That's where my concern was. And if it's Aging in the Gorge that's going to be the committee, and they might give us some feedback every so often, I'm fine with that. I'm just not sure how much bandwidth we have right now for the city staff and us to do that. I mean, they know what they need. We don't.
You know, I guess I would, you know, a committee doesn't have to be 10 people. You know, I think I would be willing to, you know, I am actually committed already to interacting with the Aging in the Gorge Alliance. So I would be willing to facilitate that interaction somehow. So if I can be a committee of one, then sign me up.
Okay, so maybe we might not call it a committee, but you might be the liaison that would be, you know, the interaction or something.
I don't envision that the AARP is going to come down and say, it's like, you know, you guys are not doing what you're supposed to do here. Suck it up and form a committee.
Okay, all right. Gladys, did you have something?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if there is any one of us that would do exactly what Tim has just volunteered to do, is to be a liaison. I think that Claire and Bonnie and Tina will give very good direction to us, suggestions. So I don't think it's something that will require for city staff to be involved on a consistent basis. So I think it'd be more of just having them inform us. So I appreciate him being willing to offer as a volunteer. And I also just wanted to note for the record that I too supported this from the beginning, this letter of support.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think if it's not going to put some additional thing on staff and Tim's willing to, you know, be the liaison, I support it. All right. Great. Anything else, Tim, besides this?
No, that's what I got.
All right. Who else do we have? Mark?
Two quick things. One is I also got calls by some of the neighbors of the warming shelter, and you know, I'm not. Sarah's done marvelous work, and you know, all the power to her, and it's a well, super needed thing. The site, just the distance to it, is I'm less than fully optimistic about where it is, and so. I think to me, if there's no time to do different things this year, then, you know, I as a counselor will certainly want to be more active in helping find a next year site or a permanent site going forward. Because I think this is the, you know, all of the entities said, nah, you know, we can't really have it on our property. And so now this is where it is. So I think that's the lesson is there. The other thing I'd bring up is that the first sense of place for this year was this week, and it was some Native Americans talking about how they're dealing with COVID in the Umatilla and the Yakima nations. And it was really fascinating. You know, it was sense of place is a favorite thing of Kim and I, and I was happy to see it going. And in December, there's a pretty cool speaker speaking, I know. So that's, she can talk about that. So that's all I got.
Thanks, Mark. Jessica?
I guess I was just gonna share as a point of information, I know, so all the public transportation entities in Oregon have to develop, well, also on the Washington side, we have to develop plans around specifically transportation for seniors, disabled, and limited English proficiency passengers. And so I know Hood River County CAT's doing theirs right now. So that's kind of more as a point of information, I guess, for Tim, perhaps. Hopefully they've engaged the Aging and the Gorge Alliance, but so there is some planning around how do we serve the transportation needs for the aging population. But that's just some information to share. I don't have other things. Thank you.
Thanks. Eric?
Thank you, Mayor. Nothing for me tonight.
Gladys?
Thank you, Mayor. I do have a couple of things that I wanted to share. First and foremost, as I've been practicing on these calls, to remind us all to continue to wear our masks and to really coordinate with our families and loved ones as we're getting closer to the holidays and potential of getting together, really trying to keep those gatherings to 10 or less. But again, please talk amongst yourselves as families and create mutual agreements about what's best for your family to keep everyone safe during COVID. I wanted to mention that before this next statement that I've made, that I've cleared it with our city attorney before I do. So here goes. We are at a time in our country where, not even just necessarily our country, but in our own little city, that there is a division amongst us. And I want to acknowledge that that is going on, and that we are also in a time in our country and in our small little town where we're making decisions about our elected officials. And so I wanted to officially endorse some candidates for not only president, but for local government. So I'll start off with presidential candidates. Fully endorse Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Anna Williams for our state representative, and I want to endorse Kate McBride as our mayor. I'd like to also endorse Megan Saunders, Mark Zanmiller, and myself, Gladys Rivera, for Hood River City Council. As I have mentioned, we have candidates that are in this group that I feel are trying to divide us more than what we already have, and we do not need that. We need to continue with the council that you see here present in video to continue unifying and to continue creating a welcoming and inclusive environment for us all. And I truly believe that if these candidates are not nominated, selected, that we will have more issues than what we already do now. So wanted to make that official. And lastly, I would like to share that I am the December candidate for Sense of Place. I hope that throughout this time, you'll get to know a little bit to know about me and my purpose, my reason as to why I am here and why I feel brave and courageous to just speak. A lot of the times, even though I feel nervous at times based on some of the backlash, but that it's very important that we just simply diversify perspectives, because representation really does matter. And in order to create a welcoming and inclusive environment, I really do have to be here, and I'm very happy to be here and to serve the community that I love so very much, which I was very fortunate to be born and raised in, and where I've chosen to live and where I chose to raise my wonderful three kids. So thank you.
Thank you, class. All right, 10:02, you guys. I remember when Arthur was mayor, he would just be starting to roll. If it was 10, he could go on and on. But thank you for enduring for this long meeting, which I consider long. And we will see you in a couple weeks. Thanks.